You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, what's going on? I'm Rob Cesternino, and I am chuffed to bits to be back here with one of my favorite podcast series that we have done here on Rob is a Podcast, because today we are going to learn. This is where I can feel like, okay, we are providing a public service here on Rob is a Podcast, and not just talking about the stupidest reality TV shows, because today we are going to be joined by a man that I can call one of my great friends is here today to answer your questions once again. For the third time, please welcome in the great Dr. Christian Hubicki for Ask Dr. Hubicki 3.
Well, thank you, Rob. That's a great introduction. As always, it's wonderful to be back. It's great to I had so much fun doing this with you the first two times. And yeah. I'm glad that we can make this happen.
So the previous Ask Dr. Hubicki's, I believe, were both in 2020. We took a year off, and now here we are back. I think we did the first two, I think November 2020 and then December 2020. Yeah.
That's right.
Basically
that's right.
Like 1 month apart, and then took 2021 off to recharge the battery. Right? And then, and then here
now
we are,
back.
And here we are back, know, early-ish 2021. And I was so happy when you reached out and said that, hey, are you up for round three? Now, is this the conclusion to the trilogy?
Well, I mean, we'll see. You know, it's going to be a cliffhanger that we have to answer at the end of this one. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a, I think that there could be legs to go on, but we'll see where it goes. Mm-hmm. I think last year you were probably quite booked. You were yes. Watching every season of Survivor.
You basically
all in a row.
Sent me off on my way to go and watch all 41 seasons of Survivor, and then I had to take care of that all year. And then this is like the first time that I'm not doing that, so this opened up my schedule. But I hope this will be more like the Fast and the Furious than say like Back to the Future.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, Fast and the Furious, where, you know, I remember I saw, we'll jump right in, I guess, saw Fast and the Furious 5. And like, that's that was, ridiculous, but Fast 5, ridiculous, but fun. And they brought in The Rock. And I was like, to that series, I was like, yeah, this could, it can keep delivering on this premise. And hopefully I hope to deliver the exact same amount of learning as you would get from a Fast and the Furious movie.
So do you think that maybe a la the Fast and the Furious franchise, will you need to bring in like other knowledgeable people like Dr. Evie Jagoda as like additional like science sidekicks that would come in and join the crew as we go along, like the Fast and the Furious?
Well, and I think that, to continue the analogy, I mean, yes, not only, but, it would be like bringing in Evie, it's like bringing in The Rock to a series. Mm-hmm. She will be no one's sidekick and will have her own franchise very soon.
Yes. Yeah. So they might leave and then start their own series. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I got to be careful for my own career, but I think that's a possible. Yeah. But I think that sounds fun.
Okay. All right. So just to set the stage for what we do here on Ask Dr. Hubicki, we open it up to the audience and we say, send us in your questions about science, the world, pop culture, anything that you feel like that Christian might be able to answer, food and drink, whatever it is. And we will see what answers Christian has. Before we get to the questions, Christian, what's been going on? I feel like I haven't really gotten to chat with you since we were talking during Survivor 41. I think we talked right after the Hourglass.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And specifically, yeah, it was right after the Hourglass twist. And I think Tiffany had gone home that
yes,
one.
Yeah, we talked about
about the various puzzles and things like that. Yes. There was the prisoner's dilemma, Shipwheel Island. Mm-hmm.
And then we got to catch up again after the do or die twist when you came on and went to the whiteboard to help explain the Monty Hall problem.
I felt this was my time, that there was I've always loved the Monty Hall problem. And I was like, wait, I have a whiteboard teaching set up here. I can text you. I have your phone number. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, let's make this happen. So yeah, I'm glad that was a wonderful little,
what a highlight.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah. That was just such a fun little diversion from my yes. evening. That was great.
People felt like you went all Steve Kornacki on us that night.
Well, you know, Steve Kornacki's got a cool job. Anyone who gets to stand at like the magic board or a whiteboard and, mm-hmm. and just do play by plays or analysis, you know, that would be a good career move for me. If that would be fun.
Yeah,
I envy the man.
Well, outside of your podcast appearances with us, what have you been working on?
So in general, I've been working at my laboratory. We've been trying to study our robotic algorithms. We're trying to make robots more reliable, more adaptive, more efficient. All those things. We got our walking robots. Now we have a couple drone flying robots buzzing around the laboratory, chasing each other around. That's been a lot of fun, and so that's led to some fun research talk opportunities. So it's been busy in my neck of the woods, but a good busy. So a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm trying to come up with the mental image of robots chasing each other, flying robots chasing each other around the laboratory. It sounds like things are pretty out of control.
Yeah, it can be. Sometimes they, they're supposed to stay in like a little area, but then there's a glitch and they zip outside. It's actually kind of funny.
They escape?
They still stay in the room, but like we have like imagine an invisible wall, like an invisible fence. They might escape their boundaries a little bit, but everything's fine. No, nothing to worry about. Fine. It's all cool here. Everything cool.
All right. What a relief. All right.
Yeah.
So Christian, I have so many questions for you. Let's dive in. And why don't we start with a question from Sarah? And this is a question I think that cuts across a few of our different categories today, because Sarah wants to know, Christian, can you talk to us about Wordle? It's a phenomenon right now, and it's such a simple little game. What are the best strategies and your thoughts on Wordle?
Great question. Sarah, was that her name? Sarah. Thank you. Sarah, thank you, Sarah. So I myself actually do not play Wordle. It is part of my programming, if you will. I don't know. I guess my brain, it's part of more things in my brain that when I see like a popular game, like a game like that, I do think about algorithms that you would use to solve Wordle. And so here in the early half of 2022, for historians listening to this in the future, Wordle is a word game, for those who don't know,
yep.
where you have to choose, you're trying to guess a secret five-letter word, and you have up to six guesses. And the key is that when you make a guess, it will tell you if you have any letters right in any spot in the right place, or they're in the word but in the wrong place. It'll give you a green letter. It'll give you a green letter if you get a letter in the right place, and you get an orange, I think it is if it's in the word, but in the wrong
yellow.
Place.
I think it's yellow.
Yellow. Okay. Orange to my eye, perhaps, but yeah, like a yellow square. Right. And so there's this puzzle where you're deducing more information and trying to guess what the word is. And there's actually more people than just me have been interested in this Wordle algorithm. I was going to see if I was going to whip one up over the weekend, but that didn't quite materialize. But thankfully, a lot of people have. And I've been checking out some of the approaches that people have been taking to Wordle algorithms. And it turns out one of the popular ones or interesting ones is to use what's called information theory in order to maximize your guesses, to whittle down the number of possibilities, come up with the right word. Okay. And one frequent thing I see people talking about in Wordle is, what word do you start with?
Yeah.
You have no idea. That's always the thing. What word do you guess as your first word? And one of the analyses that I've seen that I thought was very compelling, although there's room for difference of opinions on it, there's a video by a very popular YouTube channel called Three Blue One Brown. Okay, three blue one brown. It's a very popular YouTube channel for sort of intermediate level math teaching.
Okay.
And it's all animated information graphics. It's very well made and very intricately made, all these videos by Three Blue One Brown. And he recently tackled the Wordle algorithm. And he did a big analysis, and based on his algorithm that he came up with, he felt the word crane, C-R-A-N-E, was the best word.
Okay.
Based upon his algorithm. Okay. But that, so those looking for the headline, what word should I use? According to this interesting algorithm that he put together, it's crane. Okay. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the algorithm itself, for how do you go and find better word, what words do you choose for each of your guesses? He brings in this concept called information theory. And information theory is part of our lives, whether you know it or not. I mean, you're listening to this podcast right now. And you are either watching it on video or you're listening it to it on your podcast feed for Rob as a podcast. But either way, one of those ways, it was that podcast was compressed and then reconstructed using algorithms designed by information theory. So it's a big part of how we communicate in this modern digital information age. But one of the key ideas in information theory is taking all the possible possibilities there are for a given problem and cutting them down as much or quickly as possible. Okay, and information actually has a unit in science. Information is just like, you know, a mass might be in pounds or kilograms. Lengths can be in meters or in freedom units, feet. Information has is measured in bits, just like bits in a computer. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what you can do in Wordle is when you're picking your next word, you can determine that if a certain outcome of colored squares pops up, whether it's like green, gray, yellow, or whatever. Okay, that's if a certain pattern of squares pops up, you can go through all the possible words that are possible in Wordle and cut out a bunch of words that are impossible, right? You remove them, okay? And if you remove half of the words via that choice, then you have accumulated one bit of information. Every time that you cut the space of possibilities in half, you gain one bit. And that is the literal mathematical definition of information in this context. And there are laws of information that are as immutable as the laws of physics that apply to information. It's a fascinating field. One I just want to know more and more about. And so for a Wordle algorithm, what this particular YouTuber did is they went and looked at all the possible words that they could choose. And for each of those words, looked at all of the outcomes that could happen in terms of colored squares. And those colored squares would remove some fraction of the remaining words, giving you a certain number of bits of information. If you remove half, it's one bit. If you remove three quarters, meaning you cut it in half twice, that's two bits. You know, 7/8 of them gone, that's cutting in half three times, that's three bits. Okay. So, and he takes all of those combinations, says how many bits you would get of information you would accrue from that choice, and then averages it. Okay, so this average information that you would accrue from a given word choice has another name called entropy. And I know we've talked about entropy a few times on the podcast, Rob, in different contexts, you know, whether it's thermodynamics or whether or not a Survivor season is fun and exciting and moves around really quickly. It's this idea, it kind of roughly correlates to uncertainty. It's a really hard thing to explain. In fact, I think that's by design. I think people like to call things entropy sometimes in research because this is actually documented that when the person who really grandfathered information theory, his name was Claude Shannon, he was a scientist, he called it entropy because he was told no one really knows what entropy is, so you have an inherent advantage in any argument you get into. Mm-hmm. So you just pretend you know what entropy is. So anyone tries to question you, you can just say, oh, you don't understand it. Just because it's kind of hard to get. Yeah, it's a good move. Good move. I've seen other people do similar moves in science. It's kind of an interesting ploy. But basically, the average amount of information that you expect to get from a choice, that's called entropy, and it's measured in bits. So if you pick the word that gives you the biggest expected number of information, or bits, which we call entropy, mm-hmm. then that's the best choice that you could make because then it's likely to cut out the most possibilities depending upon your choice. So the way that this algorithm was put together, he ran it for all these possible words that could be in the Wordle dictionary. And he had some interesting results, one of which is he found that crane was a good starting word, arguably the best starting word, although he made some interesting choices about the algorithm that you could argue with, but it's all arguable. But number two is how often this algorithm would succeed in getting the word. You have six guesses. Generally speaking, I've heard people say that getting it in four guesses is that's like par. That's like hitting par on a golf course. Mm-hmm. If you get in three guesses, that's like a birdie, mm-hmm. right? And if you get in two guesses, that's an eagle.
Yeah.
That seems like an analogy I've seen people use. That seems to make sense. And so the question was, could he get a birdie every time? And that turns out, he says, it's according to this particular maximum information algorithm, it's probably not possible to get a birdie every time. Mm-hmm. So even with this maximum information algorithm. So if you get a birdie, that's great, but you have to get at least a little bit lucky or at least not very unlucky to get some consistent birdies,
yeah.
which are three guesses.
Now, Christian, does the algorithm, after it solves the Wordle, tweet out its score in a very annoying way?
I wouldn't know because I muted it on Twitter. No, I wouldn't know. That would be I've seen some people who are mean who created bots that would reply to people's Wordle tweets with spoilers of the next day's word. Did you hear about this?
Oh boy,
that's kind of mean.
Yeah.
That's one because one thing, it's a fascinating, I think it's a fascinating game. I know I've been playing, I haven't played it, but I see the elements of it. I can see why it's so addictive in this current year, early 2022. We'll see how long the fad goes, but it's designed for people to pass on, their scores, and everyone mm-hmm. sees everyone else playing it. And it's very simple, easy to pick up, and people find their own strategies. It's also a nice thing. I think you only play it once a day.
Yeah.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah. That way you're not doing it, 100 times a day. It's not destructively addictive. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Anything else about Wordle?
So I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting. There are lots of variants of Wordle. Sophie Clark sent me something called Absurdle, which I'm not sure what that is. Whatever it is, I lost very quickly.
Yeah. How does an Absurdle work? Do you even know?
I think it's designed to make you fail. I think it's supposed to be absurdly difficult, mm-hmm. and then it laughs at you when you do poorly. I heard there's like a Taylor Swift version of Swiftle or something. There's all kinds of crazy versions. I've tried not to dive too much down that rabbit hole, but that's all I got to say. I'm impressed by the theme and variation of it all.
Now, when you saw that Wordle got sold to the New York Times for, I believe, a hefty sum. Do you say to yourself, well, this is nothing, this Wordle. I could make a game 10 times better than this.
I would make a game 10 times more complicated than that. That's the issue I would run into. So, I think that one of the beauties of it is the simplicity, that there's an art form to pulling out the simplicity and passing it on as a meme. If I had a flaw when it comes to my creative drive, it's overcomplicating things. And this will probably come as a surprise to almost no one. In fact, recently I was playing a game on Twitch with Gabby.
Yes.
We were playing a game called Portal 2, which is like a puzzle game, which was huge 10 years ago. And I happened to play it. And it's cooperative. And it's a cooperative puzzle game. And so Emily, you know, was like, I was telling her about how, yeah, me and Gabby were playing. And yeah, I overcomplicated almost every puzzle. Mm-hmm. Like, so it ended up being like, no, you shoot the portal over there and then you go over there. Like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Wordle was sold for reportedly in the low seven figures. So let me just ask you, degree of difficulty, making a Wordle or Tony Vlachos winning season 40 of Survivor? Who had to work harder?
I think that Tony probably had to work harder. I think that the thing about a Wordle is it's like a lightning in a bottle thing. Mm-hmm. That you happen to get the right kind of addictive formula, right? Whereas, you know, something like Tony winning twice on Survivor, you know, he not only had to do it once, but then had to come back in with a big target as being known mm-hmm. as this big schemey player and then thread a needle and then get it again. I think there are lots of analogous games in history. Like, I remember Flappy Bird. What was that like?
Yep.
Almost 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. That was a huge thing. It was this very simple game that some guy just made. And then he was so overwhelmed by the attention it gave him. He just took the game offline and people were like selling it. But weren't people like buying iPhones for thousands and thousands of dollars because they had copies of Flappy Bird on it?
Yeah. Christian, let me bring you into another question. This one's going to be a little bit more controversial. Okay. Javier wants to know, should Pluto be considered a planet?
This is a very controversial one. And I think this debate was bubbling up in 2006. I forgot to look up the history of this.
So, of course, Pluto was a planet. Then they said, nope, not a planet. But now I feel like there's some talk of like, oh, maybe it should be.
I didn't hear about this recent bubbling up of why it should be. The general reasoning as to why Pluto was not considered a planet was taken off the list, bumped into the dwarf planet, I believe, category. Some people like spin it of like, oh, no, it's the first of this class of dwarf planets. But people saw it as a demotion and people got very upset. People had a lot of attachment to this. And I've heard, and it's not exactly clear why, I've heard people speculate because when you're learning planets as a kid, you have all these weird planet names that you don't know what they mean. Then all of a sudden you hear about Pluto and you're like, oh, there's the dog from Disney. There's the Disney dog. I know that one. Mm-hmm. And they develop an emotional attachment to it. I've heard that hypothesis as to why it's so popular. But in terms of the actual decision-making, I think there's actually a really important lesson in the classification of Pluto. Is that definitions change not just for arbitrary reasons, but it's because we learn more about where the thing comes from. Okay. You know, the criterion for which Pluto was bumped to a different category was that it wasn't round enough and it didn't seem to have a clear space of debris. There's still a lot of debris around Pluto. And those sound like, those sound like arbitrary things. Right. Well, the reason that they chose like not round enough, what are we, you know, we like body shaming Pluto and what's going on?
No planet shaming.
No planet shaming. But the reason they have the criterion is because we learned a lot more about how planets formed in the time since, I believe, Clyde Tombaugh, I think, discovered Pluto. I think it's Clyde Tombaugh. Or is it Percival Lowe? I forget which one it was. But the, and so that planets form because there becomes a cluster of mass in one part of space that mm-hmm. congeals all this dust and stuff around it in rocks, and it becomes this one spherical, like pseudo-spherical object that it formed because it dominated the planet, the gravity around it, and then it all kind of collapsed together. And that's how we learn all the other planets form, whether they're gaseous or like a Jupiter or rocky, like our planet. Earth is actually the most dense planet in the solar system.
Oh,
for those who didn't know, that's a nice little factoid that I learned mm-hmm. a while back. But Pluto, by not being so round, then clearly it didn't form in the same kind of way that these other planets formed. So it's a result of what we learn about the origins of these planets. You can say the same thing about species. There are different ways that we've categorized species over time. And recently, something called cladistics, or based on clades, is the popular way to categorize species. It used to be that you might look at a species and like, that looks like that other thing. You know, that whale is in the water. It's basically a fish, mm-hmm. you know, of course, when you know it's a mammal, and we knew it was a mammal for a long time, but it's where we learn where the species came from and what their close relatives are from an evolutionary standpoint that we actually say, oh, no, we now categorize these things together as opposed to these things, not because of their superficial characteristics, but from what we know of their lineages and how they arised, mm-hmm. they arose.
Do you have a dog in the fight and not a Disney dog in terms of a planet or not planet?
I'll say it. I think it should be a planet. I think it should not be a planet.
Not
a planet. It's like, sorry, Pluto. I have high standards for my planet. But I think it reflects. I mean, I don't know all the details of what astronomers are talking about. But I think it's important to respect when we learn more about these creatures, you know, these planets. And how they form. And I think it's important to update our categorization systems. Mm-hmm. I know it feels arbitrary and capricious, and people get emotionally attached to these kinds of decisions. I mean, it happens all the time in other species as well. I mean, dinosaurs. We now know all kinds of dinosaurs had feathers. Like mm-hmm. we have fossils that have feather impressions in them. Like, and there's all kinds of reasons to believe that they had feathers. We didn't know this at the time of, you know, for sure at the time of Jurassic Park, the movie coming out. But that is in people's heads that those are the dinosaurs. Those are dinosaurs because we saw them in the movies. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for some people to, it's hard to, for us to update our knowledge based upon what we have sort of emotionally attached ourselves to. So imagine, you know, velociraptors with full feathers. It doesn't look like the thing that ate Samuel L. Jackson, you know. And so it's kind of natural that we attach ourselves to this cultural relevance of these things. But I think it's important to take a step back and say, you know what, we've learned more and it's fascinating.
Yeah. I have a question related to the Pluto question. And this is a question that I need the help of a scientist to help me answer. Mm-hmm. Recently, my children had asked about, you know, is Pluto a planet? And my wife responded and said, no, honey, it's not a planet anymore. The scientists, they said, it's not a planet. And I said, well, what is it? She said, it's just a tiny star. And so my question for you is it my duty to give my children the correct information, or at the risk of, you know, a major fight with my lovely wife, if I corrected her, or do I just let it go?
So, good question. I can see myself treading on some more territory. Mm-hmm. I think that it would be okay. As good parents, you're no doubt educating your children, mm-hmm. you know, doing the best that you can. It's also not your job to be astronomers, mm-hmm. and you have kids enrolled in school, and your teachers will do the best job they can to correct any misperceptions. Okay. I mean, you know, that's that. So I think that
I just let it go. Didn't say anything.
I don't think it's your inherent responsibility. Mm-hmm. To correct anything, and to correct it at the mm-hmm. peril of your marriage.
Okay. Yes. Okay. And my
that's
personal
what, that's
health.
What science yeah. And your personal health. And that's what science communicators are there to do. So hopefully, at some point, you know, if your kid, you know, I don't know if it was Anthony or Dominic who asked this question. They go to school and they say, "Oh, Pluto is a tiny star." Then if they remember that, then it's like, well, you know, stars are a bit different than planets, Anthony and or Dominic, you know, mm-hmm. stars have fusion reactions or whatever they'll say.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Good to know.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to, has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry. We're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's shift gears a little bit, Christian. I have a question for you from Chris, who wants to know, what real life scenario is most comparable to planning slash pulling off an epic blindside on Survivor? Do you have anything from the real world that the Survivor fan could compare with planning a blindside?
Well, I think that we both have some good experience, I think, in this world, in this realm. I got to be a part of some good blindsides along with some of the other Davids in my season, and you personally plotted several in the Amazon. And I'm curious what you think about this answer. It's almost like you're planning a prank on somebody.
Oh,
I think that at least in this. In this modern era of Survivor, where blindsides are expected, and it was not a novel thing as it may have been back in 2003, in 2002 when you filmed it, it's because you are putting together this plan in motion, and they're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. And it's not in their best interest either. So, and it could be really elaborate. I used to be into pranks when I was like 19. I stopped being into them.
What was a good prank that you did? Do you have any? Because I feel like with your mind, I feel like that you probably engineered some epic pranks.
Nothing too epic. I had a thing where I don't know how I've discovered this, but in college, some of the couches in our dorm had a hollowed out inside underneath the couch.
Okay.
So. I think that there was like a horror movie night that was happening. And so I hid inside this cavity underneath the couch, which you would not volumetrically speaking, right, assume that a human could fit into. And so at a particularly scary moment that I knew was going to happen, I maneuvered my hand to an unoccupied part of the couch and just jammed my hand up in through the air. Coming out of the couch, and that created quite a stir and a panic. I made sure that I was informed and had eyewitnesses that would tell me that if there was any people at that part of the couch, because that could have led to problems. That's the kind of prank I would do.
Get
the signal. But that's there's normally me managing to contort my body to fit in smaller places than people would assume, and I could pop out. Mm-hmm. That's what I would do. Now, you can imagine they could do elaborate pranks with their tech pranks. There was a fun thing back when I was in early college. There was a fake version of the Windows operating system called the Windows RG, or the Windows Really Good Edition. And it was making fun of the apparent instability of Windows. And it was kind of a comical version where you had a really crappy doodle art version of Clippy, the paperclip.
Yes.
And you put it on someone's computer, and then they'd be interfacing with what appeared to be a fake Windows system. And people would basically clicking on buttons, and things wouldn't work. I would do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So nothing too harmful.
Yeah.
Well,
so in what you're saying is that I guess then maybe the greatest Survivor player who might have ever lived might have been Ashton Kutcher.
Honestly, I think that someone like that would take some glee in that sort of thing. I mean, and honestly, I look at someone like Rick Devins when I was watching him like do his
another
shenanigans.
Prankster.
He's a prankster. I was watching this guy loves pranks. Mm-hmm. So him pulling off these that's what they felt when he was planning fake idols. They're pranks. Mm-hmm. And so especially when you're trying
to. I think he might have been planning more pranks than blindsides.
Yeah, that's quite possible. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think at that point he was kind of messing with people just to throw them off their game or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's the feel of it. It's like, oh my gosh, this person doesn't know. They don't know what's going to happen. And in most of the situations I was in, like when John was blindsided, like we were on the down and out. So there was no guilt in the prank because they're like, okay, well it's either him or us, mm-hmm. and then. was like, and when the moment's approaching, you have the feeling of like you're setting up a prank. You're like, oh my gosh, is this actually going to work? Here comes the moment. And then the votes come in and it worked, you know, because and think about a prank. There's risk in there. Sometimes too much risk. You got to be careful with pranks. They can go really wrong. But that inherent risk that it might not work. And then when it does and there's a reaction, it has that feel.
How has this analogy not come up yet on Survivor? Would Jeff not appreciate this one of that, you know, planning a big move like a blindside is a little bit like planning a big prank?
Yeah, I it's possible no one said it. Mm-hmm. There's a danger in making that analogy because you could vary because then it's
jokes on you.
Jokes on you. You're the one who exactly you that's perfect because you know. And especially if you make that analogy at tribal council, then someone reading their voting confessional is like, well, guess what joke was on you, but all along. Exactly. It's a perfect setup for that. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that.
Like, I'm getting the last laugh.
I've heard even people say that reality shows in general, Survivor or more, like it's like production playing pranks on the contestants. Like the fact that you have these random twists coming, it's like, well, guess what? They won't see this coming. You know it's almost like
they've just won immunity. Little did they know.
It has that feel to it. That sort of where the anticipation of surprise the difference is the degree to which it's at their expense. You know, it can be, and I think that the modern era of Survivor blindsides are expected. So I think that it's a little bit more on the fun prank side, even though it is sad. You have to take into account the emotional impact of someone being voted out and that they're dream ending for many of these cases. So very much prank like in the feel and execution.
Okay. Let me ask you a question from Tommy Guam, who wants to know, has Christian watched The Mandalorian and Boba Fett? If so, do you have any thoughts?
So I only just recently watched these shows. They've been out, at least The Mandalorian had been out for a couple years now as of 22.
Yes. Now, are you a big Star Wars guy?
I'm an intermediate Star Wars guy, I would say. Like I've seen all the movies. I haven't seen the cartoon TV shows, those things. I haven't seen those. I mean, I grew up with it sort of generally as part of the culture. I think I enjoyed about Star Wars was the spaceships. I enjoyed the spaceships more than I enjoyed the Jedi magic and the lightsabers more. And I really like a lot of the original trilogy. I think that's where what I enjoy from the first two movies of the original trilogy, especially. And so we hadn't had Disney Plus for a long time, which is where The Mandalorian is on and these shows. And what finally we bit the bullet and got Disney Plus was the new Beatles Get Back documentary. Emily's a big Beatles fan. She's like, can we get Disney Plus for that? And I was like, yeah, we can do it for that. And I'm not a big Beatles guy, but I love that documentary. It's a fascinating delve into the creative process of the Beatles, who are basically writing these songs for an entire album, basically in a week, more or less. You know, and that's I've never seen anything like that, and that was fascinating to watch. There's funny moments, there's drama. It's kind of got everything, and it's got some good humor, and it all ends with them having to giving their final concert together on the roof of their building in London, and you have all these people who are very confused. It's like
spoiler alert,
spoiler alert.
Don't give back spoilers.
John and Yoko get together. But there's stuff in there that I had no idea. There's actually some surprises I'll leave out. But anyway, so we got it for that. And I thought, hey, The Mandalorian is on it. I've heard about this show. I've heard good things about it. So I'll put it on. And sure enough, the first season I put on, I really liked a lot of it. It's a good example of what can be a real pet peeve of mine when it comes to franchise movie and storytelling. And I think that one of the reasons, generally speaking, I generally don't enjoy prequels is because there's often a need to over explain the lore that's already in this thing you already watched. Mm-hmm. And that often comes at the expense of good storytelling. It's very, very hard to do both at the same time. My favorite show ever, Better Call Saul, I think does a good job of it. Mm-hmm. And additionally, another thing these franchises is a tendency to do is just to throw fan service into things. And it's like, hey, you remember this person from this movie. There he is again. There she is. There's people mm-hmm. you remember. Mm-hmm. You remember those? But like, and I think a good barometer as to whether or not those make sense in the story is if you are watching it and you can enjoy it, even if you don't know who these people are, even if you don't know what these references are. And I think that The Mandalorian, for the most part, does a good job of it. You know, I'm gonna sort of define a ratio for which I judge these things, like where I put myself in the mindset, if I didn't know what this thing was, would I still enjoy this? And The Mandalorian does a good job. I would say season one, I'd say about 85%. So 85 out of 100.
Pretty good.
Of the references that are in there, like they feel like they can be an organic part of the story. And you don't need to know that alien that's sitting in the background at the bar, that was in Empire Strikes Back in this one scene, this alien of the same race. You don't need to know that. It's just a character in a bar, right? Mm-hmm. Now, where it becomes problematic is I like season two less because it started to do the opposite of that, where they would say, and here's a character, and then they'll put them in the shot and I am this character. And mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, if I didn't know who that character was, this would mean nothing to me.
Even if you know who the character is, do you dock the points?
Yes, I do. I do. And it's, wow. I do. And it's not, and it's okay. And look, if you like it out there, that's fine. People are very opinionated about this stuff. Then the show is for you. But for me, when I'm watching it, it's also just a good barometer of as to whether this character fits, right? If we're on this podcast here, yeah. And then a famous like professional wrestler comes in out my back door right behind me, and people in the audience who are in the professional
John
wrestling.
John Hennigan, is that you?
Yeah, in that case,
good
we know
God,
who
it
is.
That's John Hennigan's music.
and it was someone if it's a mutual understanding that like everyone in the audience knows who John Hennigan is, that's fine, mm-hmm. I guess. But if only some subset even know who this person is, the rest of people is like, what is the purpose of this? Right. I don't get it. So when it comes to scripted storytelling, that's the thing that bothers me. Mm-hmm. So at season two started to do that a bit more. And so I liked it a bit less. So, but like that first season, there are some really great episodes I think that if you're in the writer's room as a non-professional TV writer, I think that it's a good exercise to say, if we change this character name with just generic character name, does this still make sense? Or is this in any way impactful?
Yeah.
Is this interesting? I think that's a good test of whether or not the story is working. Mm-hmm. And so otherwise it's kind of just, you know, just it's preying on the nostalgia of what you already know, which nostalgia is a fine emotion to have. But it's I think that you can strengthen the storytelling. And I think that Better Call Saul is another good example. Like my dad watches Better Call Saul and he didn't know for a while it was a Breaking Bad prequel. Mm-hmm. He was watching it. He didn't even know. And he was following along with the story. And I think that the ratio for me where it's 85% for Mandalorian season one, it's like 96% for me for Better Call Saul for the most part. There's a mm-hmm. couple things, but I'm picky. The Boba Fett show, I don't particularly like it.
Yeah.
I don't particularly like it.
Do you want to expand upon that? That I had been given some notes that you were coming in a little hot on Boba Fett.
Yeah. I may have texted your producer some strong Boba Fett opinions. I hesitate to say this is my rule. This mm-hmm. is my thing that I like to apply the standard of when you put things in a show that you should make sense in the context of the story that you're watching. There are two episodes of the current Boba Fett show. I don't know how it ends at this point. As time we're taping it, mm-hmm. it's tight taping this. They has not aired the final episode of this series. They're about to. Take two episodes. And then they bring in the Mandalorian and they're like
Purple Boba Fett.
Purple Boba Fett, like, which I like The Mandalorian just fine. I just like, but I'm kind of imagining it's like just some poor person who's just turning on, who's like on Disney Plus, just clicking on the show. It's like, oh, I've heard of the Boba Fett. I will watch the Boba Fett. He was in the Star War.
Yeah.
And they watch it. And then all of a sudden there's this character that they've never seen before. And the episode's about this character. You're like, what? What mm-hmm. is this? Mm-hmm. And so I just, so which, and again, if you enjoy it, great for you. That's awesome. But I'm just like watching this. I'm like, oh my God, what are they doing? I just, it's crazy to me.
I give you my galaxy brain take on this. Okay.
Yeah.
So they did they did the Mandalorian. And then when the Mandalorian came in, like, I was like, oh, he's like Boba Fett. Yeah. Just like Boba Fett. But he's different. And then it was all like a long con to the, oh, now we're going to bring in Boba Fett to destroy his reputation and make everybody hate him. Boba Fett was a beloved figure. You didn't know anything about him. We love Boba Fett. He's getting his own show. People despise Boba Fett.
The worst thing to ever happen
to Boba Fett was
it really,
he got his own show.
I tend to agree with the people who say it's like, yeah, one of the things we liked about him was that he was mysterious. Now, part of me says, is it impossible to make a show about him that really does add some character, even takes the character in a different direction? Like, what some people didn't like the fact that the Boba Fett character is becoming this more humanitarian figure. Fine, you can do that. I don't have a problem inherently with that. You can do that. It's just hard to pull off. And really, it's just like I realize they're not even attempting to turn it into a show that you can watch in like that you enjoy as its own story. It has to be part of this interconnected blob, which is a giant cinematic universe. And so for some people, you're going to love that because there are people that are like, oh, this is a reference to this thing from the Clone Wars and this and this and this. Mm-hmm. And then great for you. I just like, I'm watching. I'm like, no, it's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm fine. I don't need to watch this anymore. But I was surprised with how clearly they were like, okay, here's our opportunity. We got people watching this Boba Fett show. Now we're going to tie it into everything else.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it's franchise filmmaking in TV form.
Right. It's a little bit of a different experience for me that it's a thrill. I watch it with my kids and it's really a lot of like, oh, look, a Wookiee. Like, and we're excited to see something that we know. But like, so we are sort of like watching it for the stunt casting of it all. Don't really care about Boba Fett, but just happy to have some Star Wars to watch every week. So I am, grateful it exists, but I definitely hear what you're saying.
Yeah. And again, I see like as an opportunity that with good story. I mean, because I know it can be done. I think that the Mandalorian is littered with references to other stuff, like absolutely littered. But like, I think that it's just it worked. They did a great job of organically fitting it in.
Yeah.
And I keep going back to Better Call Saul because I feel like I'm impressed by how much they didn't screw up Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. I feel like that could have been a hot mess disaster. And I just think about all these scenes on the show where I know, as a person who enjoyed the Breaking Bad show, I know who that character is. But in the context of this story, that character serves this purpose and was set up for this other reason.
Yeah.
They could have been called something else and it would still serve that purpose. And so, anyway.
How about Survivor 41? Does that pass the Hubicki test of the passing ratio of if I never watched any Survivor and I came in with Survivor 41? Has Survivor, swallowed its own tail to a degree where that what is this show? What happened? What are they doing?
I think that Survivor, they really swung the pendulum from your era where you were not allowed to say anything about a past season to now you are encouraged to reference things a lot. And I think that I think it does go a little too far for me. You know, I think that's, but it, so it does. So in terms of referencing past things, I think that it gets more of a pass because it's a reality show. So I'm not going to hold it to that kind of standard.
Yeah.
I
feel like we heard a little bit from people that was like, hey, I discovered Survivor on Netflix and now I watch Survivor 41. But I don't know. Did we hear from anybody who I've never watched Survivor, but I'm going to start with Survivor 41? What does that person think?
I really am curious because there were people that got into Survivor because it was first brought on Netflix in 2020.
Right.
And so I wonder what those folks, I bet you have podcast listeners
who are
in that category. I'm curious what they have.
A lot of them went and then they binged, they started on Netflix, watched like a bunch of seasons and then came into Survivor 41. But I just am very curious to know, what was the reaction of a person who didn't watch any Survivor and for whatever reason, let me check out Survivor this fall.
And it's a tough needle to, and I do have sympathy for, especially with a long running game like Survivor. Like there's just lexicon that's just shorthand for things like what a blindside is. And thankfully a blindside is a fairly self-explanatory phrase. Whereas like, I don't know much about Big Brother, but like, I would have to be explained what the phrase backdoor means. Blindside is pretty self-explanatory. I didn't think I was going home, and all of a sudden I'm getting home. I'm going home. So that kind of stuff is good. The rules are becoming increasingly complex with Survivor. I think that's one thing it's difficult. It's hard to, and I'm not even talking about the twists. I'm not talking about like when they do the chip the wheel island. But all the nuances of how extra votes work and vote steals work is very—it's intricate. I mean, we talked. I think I was sort of text bombing your one of your podcasts one week during the Know It Alls, during the Survivor Know It All with you and Steven. Mm-hmm. There was talk over what would happen with the extra votes and like and one of these votes, and it was really. And there was a really critical part where the nuances of a particular how an extra vote would count or not count on a re-vote would completely change the outcome of the game. And I think like you and Stephen were talking about it, and I was rebutting Stephen comments in live by text to you, which you were then relayed over the podcast, which I appreciate.
Mm-hmm. We try. Not everybody gets that service. Okay.
No. Okay. Yeah. I shouldn't put that out there. Sorry. But like my point being, that there is a lot of, that there's a lot of nuance to those rules, even though the game of Survivor overall is a pretty simple one. I think that just takes a little bit of storytelling magic to get through to the audience. I think you can bring them up to speed pretty quickly. I think that once people see how an idol is played one time, they get it. Like, oh, in the abstract, you're like, oh, votes against you won't count. Okay, I guess I kind of get that. I guess that kind of saves yourself. But you don't really realize until you think it through that when you play an idol on yourself, what that does is basically bounces someone else out of the game in effect. And okay. So I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, but that's what I'm thinking about.
No, we're doing great. I want to cover a lot of ground here tonight. Sam C wrote in, enough of the Book of Boba Fett. Sam wants to know about Evie and Voce recently talked about books at Ponderosa. Surely you have a worthwhile story about what you read at Ponderosa.
So I kind of have a worthwhile story about what I read at Ponderosa, which is, for those who don't know, that's what happens that's the pregame of Survivor before we actually get sent to the island. Mm-hmm. I read nothing. I read absolutely nothing when I was in the pregame of Ponderosa. I was too nervous.
You were busy doing Sudoku and writing down what archetype people are.
That's right. Number one, you're referring to the fact that I have my code book, my Sudoku math code book that would do an alphanumeric cipher where I would type it. I would write in notes as numbers in the filled out Sudoku, and which was, you know, marginally effective at
is
most.
Is Sudoku more just, the Wordle of numbers?
It really is. I think that I see that Sudoku, like if Wordle were something that you could have printed in a book that you could have on a flight, then I think that it could be as pervasive as Sudoku is in terms of it's still a competition. But I think that you would have to have someone would have to market an app where you play it constantly and people would do it on the phone. Mm-hmm. Then it might be a bigger fad and like the two people would do it constantly, like during their days. Mm-hmm. I had this system, which I had described in the past. I think Josh Wickler actually took video footage of me explaining it with his digital camera on the island in Fiji, and I think he has like documentation of how my system worked. So I had that, and that kept me busy more than anything. But I also brought with me the Flavor Bible. I brought with me the Flavor Bible. The Flavor Bible, because I knew that in part bringing books to Ponderosa was signaling to other people things about yourself. And one thing I like to do is cook. Emily and I both like to cook together. Mm-hmm. And so, and also I was like, people see me, they're going to see me as this crazy nerd who only cares about,
is
you know,
nerdy things. Is the Flavor Bible the saga of Guy Fieri?
I think I think Donkey Sauce is chapter 3. Apparently it's the mayor of Flavortown. And more describes the, how pairings flavor together. Flavors pair together, and like, and I remember it's more of a textbook than a cookbook. And I was reading the same paragraph over and over and over again, just because I couldn't concentrate. I was trying to learn what umami was. And that's what I would do for most of the day. And I realized I can't even read. So I mostly just sat in silence, but I brought the Flavor Bible and I thought it was a good signal of like, oh, I'm into more sort of like casual hobby things. People could talk to me about this. I didn't even realize that Lyrsa from my season saw my Flavor Bible and brought her own cookbook with her. And as a signal to me that she also liked food and was into culinary stuff. And I didn't even notice. I was too busy worrying about everything else that was happening at Ponderosa. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really read anything. And I think I have a really hard time reading when I'm stressed.
Okay. All right. But you recommend the Flavor Bible.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I can't say I've only read a paragraph of it, I think that if I were to go back to myself, I would say good idea with the Flavor Bible. Instead, just get a cookbook with great pictures of food. Then you can just sort of like admire the pictures of food. And I would have enjoyed a picture book more, because then I didn't have to concentrate so hard. And maybe one about birds. I think that way I can look at pictures of birds.
Yeah, I think I'd rather look at a bunch of birds rather than a bunch of food before I went right into Survivor.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's fair.
Okay. All right, Christian. Tim writes in, what is your favorite paradox?
So my favorite paradox is something called Maxwell's Demon. Have you ever talked to you about Maxwell's Demon?
I don't think I have.
I did a little video lecture I put on Twitch one time about Maxwell's Demon. It's a really interesting paradox, which touches on a lot of topics that are hard to explain. And so, it's really counterintuitive, but it makes you think about things like temperature. Like, what is temperature? So Maxwell's Demon, I believe it was posited by James Clerk Maxwell, the physicist. I forget who popularized it. It's hard to tell if something was named after somebody because they said it, or someone was inspired someone else. But the idea is it's about whether or not you can make something that is cold and make it hot without actually burning any energy, which theoretically is impossible. Okay. Specifically, like imagine you have a box that's divided into two halves. So you like have a box and then there's like a wall down the middle of that box.
Got it.
And on one side of the box is hot air. Okay. And the other side of the box is cold air. All right. And over time, just by the nature of the fact that these temperatures are going to equal out. The hot's going to become colder and the cold is going to become hotter until they become the same temperature. That's just the way that thermodynamics, which is the study of energy, that's the way that thermodynamics works. And that's more the second law of thermodynamics, that unless you leave it alone, you do nothing, if those temperatures are going to equal out. And that's presumably what's going to happen, not to be a downer, but what's going to happen to the universe someday. That everything in the universe will become some same hot-ish temperature. You know, it's called heat death of the universe, where nothing can really happen because there's no temperature differences. But that's a downer. Maxwell's Demon. Maxwell's Demon. So that's how temperature works. And the reason that happens is because temperature is really what is temperature really? And it's basically the speed of all the molecules on average in a space, okay? That in hotter air has molecules bustling around at higher speeds. It has more energy. And that's the temperature. And so that higher speed is basically a temperature. Okay. And colder air is going to be moving slower. So it's a lower temperature. Now, if you were to remove the wall in that box, then they all mix around. Okay. The hot particles are going to bump into the slow particles. And so the slow particles are going to become faster and the fast particles are going to become slower. And they're going to bump and bump and collide around and until they're all about the same speed, therefore the same temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's go back to this box, which now has the wall back in the middle again. Now, James Clerk Maxwell posited and said, hey, what if we had a little door in the middle of that box, and we'll assume that wall is perfectly insulating. No temperature can get through. It's like a perfect magic insulator. No heat can get through. Right. Ordinarily, if you wanted to make the cold, the cold box colder and the hot box hotter, you would have to do something like make a refrigerator that would have to run on energy to pump more heat into the hot side.
Yeah.
Right. You have to do work. But what if we had a door in the middle? And he had a little demon that was there operating the door with a little lever. And that demon is going to be is watching all the particles on the cold side. And he's seeing that they're not all at the same speed. You know, some are a little faster than others. When he sees a particularly fast one coming out the door, he opens the door and lets it through. Go on to the hot side. And then peeks over to the hot side, and if he sees any slow moving particles coming through, he'll open the door and let that through the cold side, basically sorting out the hot and cold temperatures. Isn't this demon violating these core laws of thermodynamics? Mm-hmm. Because he's not necessarily adding energy to the system. He's kind of just opening a door and closing a door, which theoretically doesn't need to require any energy at all. So theoretically, it should be possible to violate this immutable law of thermodynamics. So this is a paradox. And the way that one of the ways that it was solved, the most intriguing way that it was solved, was our friend the idea of information theory again. Okay, that this demon is looking at these particles and is gathering information about them and sorting them out. Okay, and basically is assessing how much it's assessing how fast they're moving, and letting them through whether or not they're fast or slow. Okay, so there's information that is being assessed by this demon, and that this information had a unit or had this concept. It was called entropy, right? Well, thermodynamics also has the same exact equation in it for entropy, which basically says that that all systems will have this increasing entropy or non-decreasing entropy over time. Basically, this nebulous thing, like information, has the same mathematics as this thing in real heat and thermodynamics. And as a result, the way the paradox is solved is that you have to take into account the entropy that this demon is adding or adding to the system. That when you add that into the equation, then all of a sudden, all the equations make sense. That information is also a physical concept. That's sort of, it's not just this nebulous idea. There actually is real physical meaning, and it helps solve this paradox.
Okay. So, but the demon doesn't really exist. Like, this is like a hypothetical thing that happens. So I guess I'm not really sure why this is a paradox if you are like coming up with an idea that doesn't really, couldn't really happen, that you would have this demon open and closing the door.
Well, I know a lot of paradoxes don't have actual literal things that you see. Like there are paradoxes that are two observations that appear to be true, but they don't make sense together. But it's a thought experiment is the better way of me saying what this is. You can also make thought experiments that will interrogate whether or not these fundamental laws of the universe that we think are so important make sense. A classic one was back in the day of Newton, when Newton was talking about the laws of motion, and there was this idea that heavier objects will fall faster than lighter objects. Okay. And so they proposed a thought experiment. And so, like, if you had a heavy object that was attached to a lighter object, would that fall faster or slower because it's attached to the smaller object? Well, you might say, well, if the smaller object, is falling slower, it should be slowing down the heavier object it's attached to. Or because these two things are attached, aren't they both heavier together? And so the whole thing would be going faster. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so it was an apparent paradox with just even the idea that heavy objects should fall faster than lighter objects. And in fact, all objects fall at the same rate under gravity without any air resistance mm-hmm. in a vacuum.
Yeah.
So people use these thought experiments all the time as paradoxes.
But in that instance, that, you know, the paradox was because that we had incorrect information. It was sort of like based on a false idea that the heavier objects were falling faster than than the smaller objects. Like if you took out, like, instead of a demon, this was, say, like, you know, some sort of artificial intelligence that was able to identify, you know, which are the fast molecules, which are the slow molecules, and was able to move them back and forth. Like, would this continue to be a paradox?
Yeah. So the fact that they call it a demon, cause it's just a fun, cute way of thinking about it. It could be a little computer. Imagine this little computer with a sensor, right? Mm-hmm. It's not an actual, I see what you're talking about, the actual literal demon mapping, right? You could theoretically make a computer that is like measuring the particles and things, and there's lots of, there are lots of resolutions to this paradox. And the information theory one, I think, is just one of the more intriguing ones. But you can have a little computer do it. I didn't realize that people would get hung up on the demon.
Maybe just me. I guess my definition of the paradox was that, you know, you have like these two thoughts that you are trying to hold in your head, and you know, both can't be true.
Yeah, and so let's just call it a computer, and that still exactly holds. These are two thoughts that theoretically were going to be held together, but they cannot be true if as posited. So if you believe that temperature is all these particles bouncing around, fast and slow ones, and that's one thought, that's thought A. And number two, there's this immutable law of thermodynamics that you can't heat up a hot source from a cold source without doing work, without pumping in energy. That's thought B. Well, here's my thought experiment with a little computer that opens up a door ever so slightly, letting mm-hmm. these particles through.
Yeah.
Which is true? Is our model of how temperature works wrong, or is this crazy awesome law of thermodynamics wrong?
Yeah.
So that's the paradox.
I guess would it be sort of like is that artificial intelligence some sort of like perpetual motion machine where that it does it like it require a power source, and is that the energy that you'd have to put into this to try to keep those two temperatures from running into each other?
And people have proposed that as a resolution to the paradox, that maybe it takes energy to run the door. However, this has been debated by a lot of people and said, actually, that's not an unnecessary assumption that you have to make. That even if you assume that this is a magic, that this door does not require energy to open, and there are ways that could be theoretically done. I think that in theory, you can make a door that opens and closes. Like here, like imagine you have a spring, you have a mm-hmm. door that's attached to a spring, and basically it's kind of going it's opening and closing with this spring, right? And now that spring opening and closing the door, that doesn't require any work. It's just going to open, close, open, close, open, close, open, close, open, close, right? And so that's something, but the fact that it has to make it this, and you could also even jam the door with no energy costs theoretically. And so there are ways you could posit that, you know what, there is not impossible to make a zero energy door. Mm-hmm. And so they had to come up with more intellectual answers to this paradox that involve things like information theory. And so that's why. So anyway, why it's my favorite.
We have these two laws if in this scenario that one of these laws has to give way.
Yes, exactly. But basically, that's the way it appeared. But it was because. But the missing piece that made these both things work together, because it's true that particles moving around creates temperature. It's true the second law of thermodynamics is still real. That's one. Einstein called thermodynamics the most general science, which I happen to agree mm-hmm. with that statement, because it applies to more than just, you know, heating up a room. It actually applies to it applies to planetary scale things. It applies to all kinds of physics and biology. It's fascinating. And so both those things are true, but it's because we were missing this one piece of the equation. And that was the information that that this demon or computer was adding to the system.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your patience with me.
It's great. Okay. Now I appreciate you asking questions, because it's my favorite one, because it provokes so many questions and you have to like explain through all the layers.
Okay. I have a question for you. I think that this is, we do not have the asker here, maybe anonymous. What is the status update on Survivor Analytics? I love the panel at the Sloan Analytics conference last year. By the way, if you ever want to watch that, that is available on YouTube now. You can watch Kristen Hubicki and myself with Rick Devins, Sophie Clark, and Wendell Holland, right? We were talking at the Sloan Analytics Conference, which is put on. It's a sports analytics conference, which was put together by the Daryl Morey?
Yeah, Daryl Morey, yeah. Was he the owner of the Philadelphia Flyers? Is that what he is?
The 76ers, yeah.
The 76ers. Oh,
president, sorry, so, president of basketball operations. Big week.
Yeah, So he put that together. You know, it was the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference at MIT, and then we got to join virtually. That was a lot of fun. And I think we mentioned briefly on the last podcast that we did together that we also got to go to like the behind the scenes event with like Nate Silver.
Yep.
And I got to ask him about Survivor predictive models. So he probably wasn't expecting that question coming at him. At that talk, I had a lot of sort of proof of concept, like statistics and calculations that I put forward of just things I noticed about Survivor that may or may not have a lot of validity to it. I don't know, because I think it's a very complicated game. And I haven't gotten a chance to really to dive into them deeper. And one of them I thought was interesting was how can you try to predict the game moving forward based upon how much interaction you've had with the other players. Yes. In these modern seasons of the show, you're being swapped around once, sometimes twice, sometimes three times, mm-hmm. Especially by the time you get to the merge. And you have this web of connections from having been with these other players for varying periods of time. And to what degree, so some people will have more cross-mixing across tribes than others. And to what degree does that lead to more or less success in the game?
Yeah.
You know, I did a pretty rudimentary graph theory analysis. So
I thought it was very impressive.
Oh, thank you very much. Oh, thank you. I appreciate mm-hmm. that. Basically I drew up all the connections just from my season alone, from Survivor 37, mm-hmm. and put it in a big grid of like who's from the pre-merge, who was on the same beach with who. And basically it's a big matrix where all the rows were, you know, were all the players, and all the columns were all the same players. And if you were, if player one was on the same tribe as player two, in this matrix, I put a little one for like row one, column two. And if they weren't ever together in that combination, I put a zero. And that's something in graph theory, which is called an adjacency matrix, because graph theory is all about things that connect to other things more or less. So, if you have, like for instance, roads, you know, connecting cities to other cities, a graph will have these edges and vertexes, or basically the places you want to go, destinations, and the routes to get there. And I saw connections in Survivor in a similar way, that you could have players and then the relationships that connect them. And there are all kinds of mathematical tools that you could use to analyze these things. And I'm not a graph theory expert. Mm-hmm. I know enough to be dangerous with graph theory. But like I always thought it was someone who had a more depthful take on graph theory, or someone with more dedicated time to spend on the problem could take these ideas and really run with them systematically. And I always, and so I haven't got a chance to do that, but I've always been interested if people wanted to start, who have a little bit of a hobbyist interest in mathematics and Survivor, to really put those things together. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like that your findings held for season 41 in terms of Erica as the winner?
Well, I hate to punt. I didn't do the analysis for that season on with that, but like I didn't run the numbers on
because there was no tribe swap. But the thing that at first glance, I'm like, I don't know. Did she have that many connections? But I mean, I do wonder how big of an advantage was it to come into the merge, being a part of Luvu, which had the most people. Yes. So I think she's coming in a season with no tribe swap, coming in with the numbers. I think you would have the most connections.
Yeah, this is actually one of the more easy seasons to do that analysis on because everyone on Luvu were the ones who had the most connections. And again, it's hard to judge from one season, but who were the people in the final three? You know, you had two out of three of them were Luvu, right? You had Deshaun and Erica were from the original Luvu, and Luvu had had the most people going into that by far and had the most connections. Also, you could also have the people who met each other at the Shipwheel Island.
Yeah.
And also at the weird thing where they put them in the middle of the night with Brad and Sydney and Tiffany together, I believe.
Yes.
So you could do that analysis where at least they got to talk because that stuff seemed to have some impact on what people were talking about. I think that'd be more interesting to get from the players. Mm-hmm. But I think that the idea of having more connections might give people more options at the merge on average, but someone have to, you know, automate the analysis and run it for a bunch of seasons and see what the signals are. So there's definitely room for participation from anyone who wants to. So, and maybe they'll say, actually there is no signal there. It's all a wash, which I would be like, we'll see.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it really comes down to, you know, if, you know, I think season 41 is hard to do it because there was no tribe swap. But I think that like in a season with David versus Goliath, where you can spend time with potentially like different combinations of people based off of the tribe swap that were from your different tribe, you know, like take a look at Nick, who ends up like going to go to Jebeni and ends up like making like a really good relationship with two people that were from the opposite tribes. I think that that was something that, you know, will benefit you in a season where if you spent your time, you know, you were with your original tribe and you swap with a bunch of people that were from your original tribe. Yeah. I think you have less options.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a couple of hypotheses, like, does it matter if you've been with the most people or is it important that you were cloistered with a couple of people for a period of time together? Like the Jebeni were the final three of my season. And I think those are the couple of hypotheses that you could posit with that. Another good case study would be Ghost Island. Ghost Island had two swaps before the merge. If I recall, they swapped like in episode two. And then again before the merge, so they had two full swaps. So there were three different tribe dynamics going on prior to the merge. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are a couple of case studies. I think there's a lot of data there, and then you can throw in the international versions, which now that they're providing
really
more data
wild.
Too.
Yeah. Okay. Christian, we have a question for you from Damon. Hey, Christian, I get the impression that you are a very kind and considerate person. That being said, I'm wondering, what is one of your biggest pet peeves? Any bugs that humans have, which, this is a long question, really grind your gears? Maybe you could help to debug the people listening today.
So, one of my pet peeves is when people are really, really certain about things that they know nothing about. I think that I've been very lucky and that I've gotten to learn a lot about one particular field in robotics.
Yeah.
And as a result, I realize how little I know, even still, about robotics to this day. Like, you know, I think there's a bit of an adage. I'm trying to think who I would attribute it to. But the more you know about the expertise you get in a given subject, you know, the more you realize how much you don't know. Now, there is a general psychological concept called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which roughly describes the same idea, which is that where if you know just a little bit about something, you know, you are likely to wildly overestimate your knowledge of such a thing. Mm-hmm. So the way that Dunning-Kruger effect is actually quantified in the original study was what they did is they gave a population of people a very simple math test, like very simple kinds of math things to do. And so like math problems to do. And they scored everyone's math problems, and they basically put them in a percentile. You're zero, you know, first to 100th percentile in terms of your score. And then they asked you, how well do you think you performed relative to other people? Mm-hmm. What percentile would you put yourself? And everyone thought they were above average, roughly speaking. Basically, every subpopulation thought they were above average. And which led to the people who were down at the bottom wildly overestimating their ability to do these math problems. Mm-hmm. It's a famous effect. And it's been studied in lots of ways. I don't pretend to be an expert in the Dunning-Kruger effect because, ironically, I know a little bit about it. Therefore, I probably wildly overestimate my knowledge of it. So, but that is the basic concept behind it. And so what that can manifest sometimes is like so whenever I'm wading into a new field, I try to express that, like, if I'm talking with an expert or someone who knows more about it than me, it's like, I really don't know a lot about this. So, like, when we're talking about graph theory just now, it's like you said a nice thing. Oh, I thought my graph theory thing was nice. I appreciate that. I do. Mm-hmm. I do. And at the same time, I'm also trying to be like, it's like, if there's a graph theorist in the audience, they'd probably be like, Christian, you kind of got this thing wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it was fine enough for this very simple demonstration of what you could do with it. But right. So when people act overly confident about things they don't know things about, I think that becomes problematic. And that's not just about things of areas of expertise. Mm-hmm. It's also like just personal experiences, like being on Survivor is a great way to have that experience. If you go on social media and people are telling you about your own season and what was happening, right. and you're like, wait, I was there. That's not right. It's like people will confidently assert something that's happening. It's like, wait, but I was there. That's not true.
Yes. Well, and do you think that sort of like the easy access to information that we all have because of the internet has actually been where you would think that, okay, the access to information would be like generally like a good thing for society because so many people have access to information, but maybe not necessarily like a specialty of like years and years of research like in a given area that like that little bit of knowledge actually can be like somewhat damaging because you have so many people that think they are experts in different subjects in which they might be misinformed.
It's a common thing that's talked about with the internet. That's and that's not just me. There's tomes of books of people who study this kind of effect on the internet of, you know, whether it's misinformation that gets around. I mean, that couldn't be more relevant, you know, in the 2020s in world history now. But it is tough because it's hard to distinguish what is, in a complicated subject, who's telling the truth or who really knows what they're talking about. It's hard. I don't pretend it's easy. Mm-hmm. So often there is this refrain of, you know, listen to the experts. And some people resist that because, you know, that they take that as, oh, that's an argument from authority. I'm not going to listen to someone just because they claim to be an expert. So it's really nuanced, you know, you have to really take a nuanced
take.
And so what I tried to put it, so it's because, and theoretically, what does it matter that this person is an expert? What they say is either right or wrong, irrespective of who they are, right? That's what the essence of an argument from authority is. I think a lot of people have come to accept is that when it's a community of expertise who is researching and vetting a topic that is publicly debatable and it's been publicly debated among experts and also people of interests that are of competing interests, then that is a robust consensus. And if you're going to disagree with that robust consensus with an argument that you read on the internet, you know, it's like you might want to just take a moment and be like, wait, am I the misinformed person? Mm-hmm. You know, and honestly, you know, engage with someone who's like who if you don't have access to an expert, or honestly look into what this, how this has been addressed by experts in the past. I think that that's important, and I fall prey to this too. I'm not perfect. It's very easy for me when I'm delving into other aspects of robotics that I'm not an expert in. I was working with robotic perception recently, and I was just starting off in this field and really trying to delve into it. It was very easy for me to think, it's like, oh, I got the answer to this problem. I got the answer to this problem. But I needed to take a step back and say, wait, people have been working in this problem for decades. I really have to step back and do the research and see what the experts are saying about this field mm-hmm. before I just assume I have all the answers.
Mm-hmm. Christian, let's talk about something that maybe you do have all the answers for. Let's go back to robotics, okay?
Okay. Sounds good.
Some of the answers, at least. Buzz wants to know, seems like that many prominent roboticists today are applying their knowledge toward the development of autonomous driverless cars with companies like Google, Ford, and Cruise. How hard of a problem is this to solve? And what are your thoughts on how soon we'll have self-driving cars on the roads?
Yeah. So I love this question. Autonomous driverless cars, I always wanted them. I'm not a person who wants to drive all the time.
Yeah.
I'd rather spend that doing other things. I'd rather spend it, you know, prepping a lecture on my way into work, you know, and do other stuff. I know some people enjoy driving. That's great. But I'd rather not have to do it. And I try to be keenly aware of how bad of a driver I probably am as a human, fleshy human being. That was my take. I actually do work with some of these automotive companies, not on the driverless car technology wing, but I do work with Ford and Toyota Research Institute, who have these big robotic car sides. So like I interface with those people. I don't develop those algorithms directly, at least not yet. And but I do have a little bit of insight into what the researchers think about these technologies. And I've become more pessimistic as to how soon these are coming. Okay. Or I should say, I've gained a greater appreciation for how hard of a problem reliable autonomous driving is. It's very difficult. And there's actually a talk that I remember I was in the audience for a talk that is actually now on YouTube, so other people can watch it. I was at a robotics conference, and this was a keynote at a robotics conference of people, you know, an audience is exactly the audience of people that know this stuff. And it was the CEO of the Toyota Research Institute, and it's one of the many companies that's working on automating driving. Okay, and so if you people want to look it up, it was in 2016 at a conference called IROS, and the speaker was Gil Pratt. And I'm just using it as an example. He's not the only person who says this, but you can hear him make this argument that I'm going to summarize for you now, which is that as much that human beings are actually way better drivers than we give ourselves credit for.
Okay.
And now that doesn't mean that you know, many people die from lots of people die in car crashes in a given year. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because a lot of people are driving a lot. Mm-hmm. The statistic is basically that it's a 9/11 worth of people every day in the world die in automobile accidents mm-hmm. in the world.
But I would imagine a lot of those have to do with impairments where people are drinking alcohol or, you know, are tired and are falling asleep at the wheel.
That is a big part of it. Yes. Mm-hmm. And he broke down the numbers. And basically his argument was that even with other impediments, whether you're in a country that doesn't have wonderful traffic safety systems or safety systems for their vehicles or driving impairment, or basically in terms of automobile deaths, that worldwide, the total rate that there's one death in automobile accidents per 10 million miles worldwide, all mm-hmm. things taken into account. Okay. If you restrict that to, let's say, the United States or countries with sort of similar infrastructure to the United States or better. And that goes from 1 in 10 million miles to 1 in 100 million miles, okay? And you're absolutely right. A lot of that is impairment, okay? So that's a big deal. But if you self-select for people who are driving tired, drunk, or under the influence, if you take that out, it's 1 in 1 billion miles. In these well-laden infrastructure countries, and that at least according to the numbers that that the CEO of Toyota Research Institute was prodding out, he actually happens to be a robotic scientist, so I have a lot of respect for. Mm-hmm. And so 1 billion miles, that's a lot. And so if you want autonomous vehicles and you want to show that they are safe, I mean, people are only going to accept them if they are safer than people. And probably many not even then, but you have to be safer than people driving. And that's a pretty high bar to meet. How would you even validate that your car can go 1 billion miles without an accident? You have to test. And they said they talked with statisticians. You know, the statisticians would say something, you have to drive 8 billion miles without an accident. So that's really tough to do. So how do you do that? That's just the sheer difficulty of that problem. Now, there are a lot of companies that are trying to do that, and that's great. I hope they succeed, because I don't want to have to drive all the time. Mm-hmm. But basically, it is a really – the argument being made was a really difficult problem. It's a really difficult problem. Now, this talk was from now 5 years ago now. Yeah. It's crazy to think about that. So things, you know, I'm sure are getting better, but it's still – there are a couple of other factors too. So another of which is that people have seen cool demonstrations of driverless cars. You know, there's the Teslas, they have the autopilot and things like that. But one thing you have to be cautious about when you're looking at driverless car results is it doing easy driving? Okay. Most of the driving that we do is very easy. And you know, you're driving straight in the highway, you stop at the stoplight, you go, weather is nice. So there could be and also the places where they're rolling out these autonomous vehicles, it's where the weather is nice. It's Arizona. I was actually just recently in Phoenix I met Tyson for the first time. We saw driving by where some driverless vehicles drive around, mm-hmm. but they'll test them in places where the weather is nice. So that's a bit of a selection bias. So you have to be careful in thinking how close these things are to being real and in your lives where you can count on them for the whole country all the time and to do the things that are difficult.
So that sounds like that's for, okay, I'm going to take, like, I'm going to be asleep. The car is driving. But I mean, how close are we where it's like, okay, well, the car is doing the work, but, you know, I can take over if necessary.
And this will get a little bit more into the weeds where I wish I was an expert in the autonomous driving division. But one thing that experts in this field will talk about is something called the handoff problem, where, let's say I'm paying attention, you know, like alert, you know, I'd be ready to take the wheel when it beeps at me. Like, let's say the system, you know, realizes it's in a situation, doesn't know what to do. It beeps at you. Are you ready to take the wheel? And this is called the handoff problem. Mm-hmm. How do you find an elegant way to hand off to the person that is no longer that is now their responsibility to drive? And that's not an easy thing to count on necessarily. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance in autonomous driving, and there are different levels of autonomous driving. There's levels 1 through 5. I could go through the categories, but it makes sense why it's very difficult. It's something that you have to get really, really right in a situation where there are people doing some crazy things sometimes. Yeah. And also you got to count on the person taking over when things go wrong. When you're dealing with human machine interfaces, it gets very hard. So I hope they succeed. I think that there's some good approaches, but I'm gonna have to be patient for it. That's what I'm planning.
Okay. All right. That's actually a very interesting answer, because I really thought that it was close. I mean, I see news articles about how, like, oh, they're doing, like, you know, they're getting trucks outfitted for, you know, self-driverless trucks. And then in terms of, like, talking about, like, delivering things, which is, like, a big problem mm-hmm. right now. But yes. It sounds like that is not something that is going to be, you know, a fix anytime soon.
I mean, and maybe for trucking, I mean, I'm not an expert in the trucking part of this. I mean, there's far fewer trucks, you know, out there. Well, actually, I'm not even sure that's true. I should not even say that because a lot of the economy just driven on trucks. So, it's a constantly changing landscape, but I haven't seen anything that has shaken my skepticism that it's right around the corner. Incremental improvements, absolutely, but I'm ready to be patient.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Christian, I want to go back to talking about something that I think could be interesting in terms of getting your view on a television show, a Korean television show. Kyle asks, if there ever was a season of The Genius in America, would you want to be on it? How do you think that you would do? Now, are you a big Genius guy?
I love The Genius, Korean show The Genius. I love it. You know, I'll go from being a downer about autonomous vehicles and the universe ending and the heat death of the universe to an upper. I love The Genius. Yeah, and I think that is a show that definitely can work in America. I could see why people I could kind of put myself in the minds of a producer and be like, it's a little cerebral, but the games and for those who don't know, the games in The Genius is not people solving differential equations. Mm-hmm. It's these very simple games that are like rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah.
Or that these people are playing, and it's survivor like. It's sort of the deception and betrayal. But it's also these reveals of like, oh, there's a layer to the game I didn't understand before. And then it's famous for these reveals where they would flash back earlier in the episode to when someone figured out some key clue and they played the song by, was it Moby? Extreme Ways.
Well, Christian, you know, a few years ago that I Stephen and I, we watched the first two seasons and we did, Genius Know-It-Alls for the patrons. And at the time I was like, well, you know, based on what we're seeing on American television, I don't know. I don't think so. I'm probably not. The landscape of American television or international television has changed so much in the last 4 or 5 years with that. Like, for instance, on Netflix, I watched a Korean dating show a couple of weeks ago, which aired on Netflix with English dub. So, like, I think that the possibility between all of these streaming sites with all these different players that are out there in terms of, like, all these different networks wanting something different, especially with the popularity of something like Wordle. Like, I could see a Netflix or Hulu or other streamer taking a chance at a more cerebral type of reality show.
Yeah, I know I'm biased. I love cerebral things, but I think it's very doable. Now for people who go and watch The Genius for the first time, and hopefully based on this recommendation, I think that one of the things that's a little tough for American audiences is that some of the games and are very culturally specific to mm-hmm. South Korea. They play Yutnori, and they particularly play a tactically upgraded version of Yutnori. They play tactical Yutnori. I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. So it's very complicated. But they can easily adapt a lot of these games. I mean, the popularity of Squid Game, you know, that's another thing. Like that's another, you know, Korean made show. I think that it really could work. I mean, I don't want to dodge the question that was asked, like, would I play it? Yeah, that'd be fun to play. Honestly, it'd be more fun to produce and or host. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to explain
interesting
these games as they're going along.
Yes.
Like, I mean, that's a big ask. Like, so, you know, just make me host a show. But I'm just saying, but I love to be a person, like, I would love to talk to people who would be making that show and come up with ideas where we make it more, maximally accessible to an audience where you have kids watching it and they get what's going on. And I think that I would change the branding a bit where you don't want it to like the casting of the show is interesting in Korea, where they basically pick people from all kinds of different fields. They're giants of different fields. You'll have someone who was the Goliaths, if you will. Right. It's pretty much what it was. You had, like a professional StarCraft player. And you had a professional music producer, and then a young pop star, and
TV presenters,
poker players, right? And I think that's a good idea. I think that, but I think that it could be improved that if the theme of The Genius was that anybody could be a genius, that there's a genius in all these, that there's a genius in everyone, that if you just kind of figure it out or think it through, you can do something awesome. And I think that would be that might be a way of making it accessible. I mean, you can celebrate also these people who do amazing feats. I think you can do it in the same way. But I think that if the theming is that, like, oh, you at home, you're watching this, you could be a genius too. Look at that. You know, you could have figured that out. Mm-hmm. And or maybe you did. And so I think it could be very empowering. And some of the moments, the reveals, they're wonderful to watch. They're so invigorating. They're like, oh my gosh, that person got one over on the other person because they noticed this clue on the wall or whatever. You know, mm-hmm. it's really cool.
Christian, could you give us any of your thoughts for who would cast on the American Anyone Can Be a Genius?
Anyone Can Be a Genius. So put Gabby on the show.
Gabby
on the show for sure. Put Gabby on the show. And so, like, if you I think that I would go around to people from all walks of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could go with celebrities, and that's fine. But honestly, like, I think that the people that they got for Korean celebrities on that show were like really high tier celebrities.
Mm-hmm. You want like I'm a three handicap Wordle player. Like, okay,
yeah, good. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there's the Korean version, like, you know, the StarCraft player guy they got, he's a really famous star. Even I knew who he was. I'm like, oh, I'm not even that big of a StarCraft guy. And so I'm not sure I would go the celebrity route in the United States because I don't think it's very hard to get high, you know, an A-list celebrities mm-hmm. to be on the show. I would go all walks of life kind of thing.
A little bit more like a tough as nails type casting.
Yeah. Except it's like, yeah.
And smart it could be as like, nails. Oh, smart yeah, as a tech.
I mean, and I think that like you could find people, you know, like, you know, who work behind the counter at the Macy's, right? Mm-hmm. And happen to be like really good at Wordle or something like that. You can find, and I think that way you could make it meet with the theme. And I would go with that way. So I would cast all walks of life plus okay. Gabby.
So, you know, Christian, we have, you know, a wide audience here on this podcast. I don't want to, a lot of people listen. So if there are producers listening who can option the American version of The Genius, you would throw your hat in the ring as the, would you be the host or bandage man of American Smart as a Tech?
As far as attack, that's I don't know to what degree my hosting skills would work, but like I would serve wherever needed. Like, okay. If they wanted, if for some reason they thought I'd be a fun host, sure. But I think that would be more likely. I mean, would be more likely that if I would love to talk with them and say, hey, here's some ideas. Mm-hmm. How do we make this
executive
accessible?
Producer Christian Hubert?
That would be cool. Banished Man is hilarious, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I also just love explaining things. So mm-hmm. if you any opportunity to give me a chance to explain things,
maybe
I mean,
there
that's
could
why
be
here.
A bandage robot. Have you considered maybe adapting that?
Bandage robot. I think that could work because I think the nice thing is that with the Bandage Man character in The Genius, it's kind of this weird cultural. I don't know if it's a cultural thing. It's odd, but weirdly it works. It's just like a disembodied voice that's mm-hmm. explaining the rules and with a voice modulator. So a robot could serve that just fine. Have a robot voice.
Okay.
Yeah. Would you want to be a dealer? Would you want to be one of the dealers,
sure.
Rob?
Or what why not? I mean, it's if you'll have me, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Why not? One of the dealers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Patrick in Maine wants to know, what is your second favorite sandwich behind the Reuben? If you can't pick one, feel free to make a Mount Rushmore of sandwiches.
my sandwich list tier is pretty straightforward. I mean, beyond the Reuben, and the reason I like the Reuben, I like the Reuben sandwich. I enjoy a well-made Russian dressing with the right amounts on top mm-hmm. of this really tender corned beef. If the corned beef is too rubbery, it's not going to work. It's got to be nice, and it's not going to work. You got to be nice and tender. Nice fall, and it falls apart. And my second choice is actually very mundane. It's hamburger. And those are sandwiches, right? This is not the hot dog sandwich, are
you? Yeah,
right?
I think you'll get probably less pushback on hamburgers as a sandwich. Okay.
Right. So I just, if you get things in the right proportion, it's fantastic. I remember one of my favorite meals I ever had. I just went to, I was at like a winery. It was so odd. It was like a winery and they had a very nice restaurant and I ordered a burger and it was just, everything was in the perfect proportion. They actually had a pickle that was the very thinly sliced and the diameter of the burger itself. And it was, I don't know how they made this giant pickle. And so it was just, so it's covered the whole burger and it's just the perfect amount of crisp, to the texture of the burger. Mm. And I remember, so after I got off of the, I'm back in Survivor when I was back at Ponderosa after I was voted off, there was no Reubens, didn't have Reubens. I did order a hamburger though. And so I was very excited. Like, okay, I'll have a hamburger. And this is probably the second meal after I got off the island, I'll have a hamburger. And so the waiter comes out, is so jolly, so friendly. I was like, here's your hamburger, sir. I was so happy. And it was a bun with a slab of ham on it.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, I just smiled like, oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I tried to be polite, but it was just like, oh, I horribly miscalculated. Apparently in a lot of countries, if you want a hamburger, you order a beef burger.
Beef burger. Oh, interesting.
You call it a beef burger because they will just give you that. They you know, that way they give you beef on a bun. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are vegetarian and vegans, I have to say I have been generally impressed by the Impossible Burger.
Impossible Burger. Not bad. I've had it. I'll have it sometimes.
Yeah, I sometimes I'll go to the Burger King just because they have it, you know, instead of, you know, just so I can cut back on, you know, just my red meat intake. But yeah, I'm very impressed by the way that they taste. And I know I probably mentioned on a previous podcast with you when you're talking about, I think we're talking about CRISPR technologies and genetic engineering, that they produce some of the ingredients of that. With genetically modified yeast or bacteria, I forget which one. I think it's yeast, and so that way it creates basically instead of creating whatever goes in beer. I didn't prepare for this part of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing whatever you need in beer or making whatever goes in beer, it brews part of the blood molecules called heme. And they brew it. It's crazy. But they found that it's one of the things that makes beef so tasty to us is that it has this heme molecule in it. So it's crazy. I think that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Yeah. All right. Do you want to round out the Mount Rushmore of sandwiches?
Oh, it's going to be tough here.
Or are you only too deep on sandwiches?
So if you, we'll put me on the spot here. We'll put me on the spot. And so, for sandwiches. So I like the Reuben. I like the burger. So we're going to go, I used to hate cold cuts when I was a kid,
yeah.
but Once you drizzle a little bit of olive oil on a cold cut to add a little bit of moistness to it, I love it a lot. And now, as an adult, I enjoy the cold cut a lot more.
Okay. What cold cut?
Well, I mean, cold cuts just are like different versions of salami, spices, salamis,
okay, and
just needs a little bit of cheese, just a little bit of cheese, and you're good.
Okay.
And I'll go with a classic Philly cheesesteak. Classic Philly cheesesteak, really nicely done. Okay. Good mix of cheese on a hot grill put in there. We've recently, Emily will make bulgogi cheesesteaks. So bulgogi is like a marinade, a Korean marinade, which is a sweet marinade that you put on beef, and it's kind of, so it ends up like a slightly sweet marinated cheesesteak. So we've been doing that recently too.
All right. So the Mount Rushmore, Christian Hubicki's Mount Rushmore of sandwiches, the Reuben, the hamburger, salami sandwich with olive oil.
I gotta say, the cold cut really doesn't feel like it belongs anymore now that I'm putting it on the spot. But we'll put a tentative cold cut on the Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. But the cheesesteak is very good.
A Philly cheesesteak.
Philly cheesesteak. I gotta say though, I wanted something lighter on this dang, you know, Mount Rushmore sandwiches. I tend to go for these heavy sandwiches.
What's a light sandwich?
What are light sandwiches?
I don't think there's too many light sandwiches. Yeah.
Wraps are
turkey.
Arguably, you know. Yeah. I mean, I can enjoy a nice open, like, you know, turkey sandwich, a lot of gravy, but again, it's also real, but that's heavy now. I like it because it's heavy. I tend to like heavy foods. So I feel I needed something light. So, you know, post in the comments below a good light sandwich so I can replace cold
BLT? Is that light?
Yeah, but BLT is good. I'm just not, BLTA, put a little avocado on it. I enjoy it a little more. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So here's one from Anonymous. Does Christian have any advice for being more confident in yourself?
Oh. So great question. My unexpert advice that because I have a lot of students who have to give presentations a lot.
Yes.
Of their work.
Yes.
And what I tell a lot of, and rarely are they not nervous, especially for the audiences they are standing in front of, because they'll be presenting a lot of them for the first time. They're like, oh, here's my new research. And they'll be standing in front of an audience of experts in the field. And I'll tell them that you feel more nervous than you look. And as a general rule, most of the time, people feel more nervous than they actually look. I tell them the story, and since this is like a public speaking thing, and so that's just an example of where confidence should come across. You know, that's an important aspect of that's where confidence is important. And so I think that I tell them the story of my very first talk I ever gave to a scientific conference, and the talk really went well. I was very pleased. In hindsight, it was. I look back on it with a lot of pride. But at the time, I was standing behind this podium, and my leg was literally shaking, literally shaking. And people like I was saying that, and people were like, oh, I had no idea. I had no idea. You were shaking, you were trembling, and like, you know, I was like, yeah, I literally was. And so, I think when people, perhaps if you realize that people don't know that you're nervous and don't, I mean, that might turn down the nerves for you. Now, again, my non-expert opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and perhaps when it comes to, you know, interactions with whatever in your life where you want to be confident, I think that realizing that you don't look as nervous as you feel might be a way of assuaging the fact that people aren't looking at you and noticing how nervous you are. You know, you might just, you know, and to this day, I have a hard time noticing when people are nervous. And I should be more attuned to that, because kind of in my job as a professor, a lot of people are nervous to come up to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, I have a position of authority at the head of the class when people want to come up and ask questions about it. So anyway, I think that notice, and I forget that these students are probably shaking like leaves sometimes. So I think that recognizing what you externally appear does not actually comport with how you feel. That can be a good tool.
Okay. Let me ask you a question from another unknown listener. If the sun is hot, Christian, why is space cold?
Oh, this is the thermodynamics. Planets are hot.
Why is the space cold?
So this is thermodynamics night tonight. I love it. Or heat transfer specifically in this case. This is also super topical with the launch of the new James Webb Space Telescope. Did you hear about this? This launched in December, maybe November of 2021. So very recently. So why is space cold? Well, first off, space is the only thing that can be hot or cold is matter. Is stuff, and space is a vacuum. So it's in a weird way, space can't be cold because it's not. Outer space is just
nothing.
There's nothing there. But what you're getting at correctly is like why do things get cold in space? Yeah, you know, you watch a movie. Sometimes you'll see like you know when something gets sent out to space and they'll suddenly freeze up. You know, I don't know how accurate the actual freezing up is, but the reason things largely get cold in space. It's because of the way that heat is transferred in the universe, okay? And there are three primary modes of which heat is transferred. The first is called conduction.
Yeah.
And we'll analogize this to cooking, because I enjoy cooking. So conduction
You read the flavor Bible.
I know. I read exactly one paragraph
it's what
of
they
it, so I'm an
swear
expert.
People in on at the food court.
That's a good joke. That's a real good joke. So conduction... is if you were to put a pot or a pan down on, say, an electric stovetop.
Yeah.
You are making contact with the thing that is hot. You're touching it and it's transferring the heat to the thing you're touching. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's conduction. Number two is convection. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's when liquids or gases are hot or cold and they will kind of rub up against something and then they will either add heat or take away heat from the thing they're rubbing up against. Now, fun fact, both liquids and gases are both considered fluids. Okay.
Okay.
So in terms of physics, if you wanted to learn about gases or liquids, you would take a course in fluid dynamics. Mm-hmm. That's the course that's taught in my department. So there's a difference, technically speaking, between a liquid and a fluid. All liquids are fluids, but not all fluids are liquids. So, because gases are also liquids because they flow. Flu sort of means flow, right?
Okay.
So things flowing over, that's convection.
Yeah.
Now, neither of those things are in space. Neither of those things are relevant in space when you're floating out in the middle. You're not touching anything. There's no fluid bouncing off, flowing off of you. So there's the third mode of heat transfer. It's called radiation. Okay. That doesn't necessarily mean anything about the Incredible Hulk. It's radiation just means that there are photons going through space that bounce off you and heat you up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you're under a heat lamp, even if there was no air in the room that was flowing over and heating you up, you could feel the heat of the heat lamp on you. That's radiation. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's how we get our energy from the sun, is from the sun's radiation. So now, why are things cold in space? If there's a sun there, then isn't it heating us up all the time? Well, it's because the sun is not the only thing radiating heat and losing heat. It's you. You are too. So when you're in space, you are radiating heat off of you as well. And there's not much keeping it in unless you're a planet with an atmosphere. Okay. So the Earth's atmosphere has a layer of an atmosphere. The Earth has an atmosphere that helps trap the heat in for reasons that are more complicated than I'm prepared to explain today. So that's why the Earth can be warm, but if it had no atmosphere, it'd be much colder. The heat would radiate off of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And all things radiate heat. Even things you can't even see light off of. There's something called black body radiation, which basically imagine you have like a black, a black kettle or a black frying pan, and you heated it up, or if it has any heat on any temperature whatsoever, which it mostly does, if it's at a normal kind of temperature, it is radiating heat. It is radiating heat off of it in the form of infrared radiation.
Mm-hmm.
This is how how thermal cameras work. They are seeing the infrared bleed off of the off of objects, and there's more infrared when it's hotter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at some time, if you heat up that black body enough, that it's called black body radiation. That's what it's called. And and if you heat it enough, it jumps from infrared to glowing red. You actually see the red.
Yeah.
And then if you heat it up, then it'll jump up to white. It'll become white hot if you can heat it up enough. And this discrete jump from infrared to red to white, and not a lot in between, was a real problem for physicists back around the turn of the 20th century. Why is black body radiation so strange? Why does it jump all over the place? And it turns out one of the key answers was this weird thing they didn't understand called quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. So that's for another time, though. So all these things out in space are radiating heat and they're losing it. So things get cold, right? So whereas the Earth is warm because it's able to have an atmosphere that keeps the heat trapped in from being radiated away. Now, why is this relevant? Well, so things tend to be cold in space. But recently there was the launch of this James Webb Space Telescope, okay, which is basically the new hipper, awesomer Hubble that can see further off in the distant galaxies. And the way that it does it, they want to be able to see galaxies that are further away. And this problem of things being cold in space and the fact that all bodies leak off radiation, this black body radiation or some kind of radiation, is a problem for the telescope. That basically the amount of heat that is just generated by the computers on board themselves is a problem. It heats up the satellite it heats up the telescope too much, and it leaks infrared radiation, which the telescope is designed to see infrared radiation from other stars. Mm-hmm. So if it's being blinded by its own infrared radiation, it won't be able to see all these stars off in the distance using infrared. Mm-hmm. So they actually have to cool down the telescope to be cold. It's not cold enough in space for the telescope. And they actually have to shield it from the sun, from heating it up too much. So there's this massive heat shield on the telescope that is always facing the sun. And there are five layers to it. It's this massive unfurling thing. And it was so complicated. There was a tear in this foil of this heat shield. So I think it set back the project like years. It was like when they were fabricating it. And so they actually need to make the satellite, they had to make the telescope colder, so that way it wouldn't be blinded by its own infrared radiation. Mm-hmm. It actually had to be colder. So it's a fascinating engineering feat that they had to do. And the reasons that it has to see infrared is also interesting too. But that's the long and the short of why things are cold in space. They radiate its own heat away and it's not trapped in. But sometimes it's not quite cold enough for a telescope.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea about the telescope.
Yeah, just as a, I'll put in air quotes, quick aside, the reason that they're using infrared, they want to see infrared light, is because of something called redshifting. So redshifting is something that happens out in space when something is moving far away from you really quickly, that the light that's coming towards you shifts to a lower frequency infrared, because it's moving far away from you. It's the same reason that if you are out in the street and a car is and an ambulance is driving by you and as it's driving up to you, it goes wah 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 wah. The frequency, the pitch gets higher and higher as it gets close to you. That's mm-hmm. the Doppler effect. And then when it goes past you, it goes, and then the pitch drops. The same thing happens with light when things are moving super fast. So things moving away from you super quickly, will have lower frequency light. It gets redshifted, and so some galaxies are moving away from us so quickly that you can't even see them with the naked. You can't see them with normal light. You have to see them with infrared. So to see our galaxies very far away, that are moving really far away from us really quickly, they have to use infrared telescopes. And the reason that these galaxies are moving away from us so quickly is because the universe is inflating. And that's something we've determined. And just like a balloon, if you are inflating a balloon and you're on the edge of, you're on the skin of a balloon, and you are nearby some other point on the balloon and it inflates, those two dots on the balloon will start to expand away from each other. Mm-hmm. And a dot that's further away from you on that balloon will go away even faster. than the one that's closer to you. So the fact that these galaxies are further away means they are necessarily they are moving far from us faster. So anyway, so that's because of the inflation of the universe, we have to have a cold telescope.
Yeah. They'll all be coming back to us one of these days, right?
Or the heat death of the universe.
Yeah.
Right? One of those two. Yeah. One of those two fun ones.
Get a good look.
So there's I'm not up on the hippest, newest cosmological data, but like that was always the debate, I think decades ago, was is there going to be a big crunch where everything comes back together and everything, you know, like where all the gravity of the universe puts us all back into one. Into one little point, and maybe we explode all over again. You know, I'm hand waving a bit here. I call that the big crunch, but I had lost favor to the idea of heat death because the fact that the universe is inflating so quickly that it's unlikely that these things are going to come back and see us again. So there we gone forever. This is a long tangent about cold space, but. If this at some point that this inflation becomes so big, we actually know that there are some galaxies that are moving away from us so quickly, it's actually faster than the speed of light. Meaning that we are being separated faster than the speed of light could ever catch us up. So we will never see those universes. They are unobservable. Now, that does not mean they are moving faster than the speed of light. You know, how fast you are moving is how fast you're moving along the skin of that balloon. We're actually being inflated and pulled apart from each other. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't inviolate any kind of weird Einstein relativity, the fact that we are inflating. And so they are beyond a horizon for which we will never see.
Wow. Okay. That's a wild twist at the end.
There's all kinds of cool implications, and it's believed that, you know, if this inflation goes on for a long time, you know, all the galaxies will be so far apart from each other that they will all be beyond this horizon that we would never see. And there is a physicist, I believe it was Lawrence Krauss, I forget who it was, who said something I remember stuck with me, that people in the future, if they didn't know about these galaxies, they've all dipped behind this horizon we'll never see, they would observe the universe and just assume there are no other galaxies because they had never seen any of them. They would come to the wrong answer based upon all the information that they have. It's fascinating. Maybe that's a more interesting paradox for you, Rob.
That was wild. That was the thing I did not know.
Cosmology is... cosmology is a crazy place, so there's a lot of cool stuff there.
Okay, let me go back to Survivor. I got a couple more questions for you. Billy wants to know, what's it like being an academic and doing Survivor? I'm doing a PhD, and I've always loved to go on Survivor, but I worry about how much time it would take away from my work.
Do it. Go do it. And this applies not to just people like, was it Billy? That's his name?
Billy.
Billy? Thank you, Billy, for the question. So I felt I was in this exact same position when I was in graduate school. I had waited for a long time in graduate school to even apply for the show because I'm too busy. And now I look back on that time, I was like, I really should have gone back then. If I did ultimately apply and they ignored me for a while, but, you know, so it's not like it was really my choice. But the idea that I was too busy to go in hindsight was now like it was completely wrong. Like it would have been easier in terms of my when you're a student, there are lots of opportunities to take leaves of absence from your program if you're an academic. And generally speaking, just as a general rule, and this is not even for academics, this is for anyone, and sometimes these things come around and. You know, it's worth reassessing your priorities if this opportunity comes. Like, I remember when I got the call to go to the show, I got the official call that, Christian, you're on the show. I really wasn't sure if I was going to go. I was really concerned about, you know, my job, but really also I had a job offers that I had to get a job. I was at that point, I wasn't a professor. I was trying to become a professor. And so it was, and Survivor was right in the middle of the season where you people apply to be professors. It was crazy. I actually, I gave an interview about this to the Chronicles of Higher Education recently. I talk about this in a lot of detail about what it was like to be an academic on Survivors. You can find that article in the Chronicles of Higher Education. There's not a paywall there, even though it appears there is. There's no paywall if you want to read it. Even then, I was considering not going. I actually
just to keep away the easily defeated.
Yeah, apparently. So it's a half-hearted paywall. And so I was really concerned for a number of reasons. One was about the timing of the job, because I needed a job, but I managed to make it work. I somehow managed. I actually signed the paperwork to take this job I have now the day I left for Fiji. That's how tight it was. Mm-hmm. Like at that point, my phone was taken away and like I was not going to be able to communicate with the outside world. So I got the job just in time.
Yeah.
But I was also worried about the perception of academics, what they would think. You know, like Ivory Tower people and I'm on a reality show. I was worried about that. And but thankfully I got some advice from some more grounded academics. They'll be like, what do you mean you're not thinking of not going? That's crazy.
Yeah.
You've always wanted to do this. This is only going to come around once, you know, and it's easy in a lot of jobs to get so career oriented that, even when I came back, like I scheduled to come back to work the day I got back. Like I didn't take any time off. Like, and then I got back and I went through this whole crazy experience and I was like, what am I doing? The lab doesn't need me today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't work at a hospital. I'm not saving lives. You know, I think what I do is important, but you know, I also have to be a person. Mm-hmm. So anyway, sorry, Rob, looks like you wanted to say something. I
feel like that if you have this opportunity, I think you should take it. I think that, you know, and I've talked to many, many, you know, hundreds of people that have played the game. I think very few people regret going on the show the first time. I think if, you know, when people regret going on the show, it tends to be, I feel like that they went back and I wish I didn't go back, or I went back too soon. I wasn't ready to go back. And I think that a lot of the people that have regrets about Survivor, those regrets are about returning to Survivor. But I would say that, you know, like I don't want to make a blanket statement here. I'd say that 90 or so percent, like I'd say it's in the 90s of people that did Survivor. Like, do you regret going on the show? I think I said it up the wrong way. Would you wish you didn't go on the show? It's in the 90 percentile of people say, no, I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Even the first boots, I think like, you know, if they went back to, you know, people that are, you know, didn't do well, you know, I don't want to single people out, but I think almost all of them would say, you know, I'm glad I did this.
Yeah. And also Billy, I think, is talking about even applying for the show. I mean, one experience applying is important. It's even outside of you getting on the show. It's a good exercise in talking about what you're all about. You know, how often do you have to talk to someone like that's a stranger and tell them this is why I'm interesting to be on?
Depends how many dating apps you're on.
Oh, that's a good point. I don't have my lot of experience with that. So this is what I'm all about, and in a way that is packaged for television. That's especially if you're in academia, you have to sell ideas all the time. You have to sell why your research is cool. And I'll tell you, there was never any better job interview experience than sitting in front of Lynn Spillman. I have to say that was the toughest interview I've ever had to do. And so I had to make Lynn laugh. And like, that was my goal. I got to make Lynn laugh. And they're trying to throw you off your game. They ask me all kinds of wild questions. I think that the entire casting experience, while it could be a roller coaster, like even if I had never gotten on the show, the experience of going through casting, if you get that far, that itself would have been a life story for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting that you felt like you needed to make Lynn laugh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my thinking was like, at that point, I was like, I'm not stupid. they want me to be a Cochran.
Yeah.
If I'm at this far, the process, they see some Cochran in me, and Cochran was funny. Mm-hmm. So I have to make Lynn laugh. So I had a couple of pre-pat jokes in response to tough questions. I anticipated she would ask me about sex robots. I just anticipated that she would.
You knew. So I was, you intuited it.
And I just like this is what the kind of thing a casting producer would do. They would try to throw you off your game. Like, how would this guy handle a sex robot? And so I just like, oh, I'm sorry, we didn't cover sex robots in robot school. Mm-hmm. That was my quip. But then I would, the blanket answer, right? There's a quip, and I would get a chuckle out of it. But then I would follow up with the actual technical aspects of a sex robot.
You had that ready to go.
Yeah, I had that ready to go. But that was an experience, I at no point in the process, like when I was being invited out to interview for Survivor, did I say, yep, I'm going to be on the show. I was fascinated I got that far. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't believe they are going to fly me out to talk to them. I'm going to talk to Jeff about math. That's mm-hmm. what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And that was so much fun. But then eventually it became clear. I was like, oh my God, they might really want me, and that it slowly would dawn on me. But like, the casting process itself is worth going through, mm-hmm. in my opinion, even if it doesn't work out for you.
Okay. Al wants to know, if you were told you had to start making a pilot for a TV show this instant, what would the premise be? Thanks, and hope you're having a great day.
Well, thank you very much for the well wishes. Well, obviously the American Genius, I love the American Genius idea. If I were to, like, if this is something that, like, I was making a pilot for, like, I don't think I'm equipped to write fiction at this stage. I haven't given that much of a, that's not on my list at some point, but I'm not, I don't feel like I've got enough practice to write fiction, mm-hmm. but I would love, if I were involved in a TV show, it would be something like one of these science popularization TV shows. Mm-hmm. There's sort of the gold standard, a couple gold standards of these over the years. Like, people know Bill Nye the Science Guy. People yep. remember him fondly and rightfully so. And I think the holy grail of a lot of these shows was Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who are into Carl Sagan's Cosmos, I believe in the 70s and 80s. And he's just got such a hypnotic way of drawing you into material. Not necessarily I'd be on camera talent, but like, he's got a way of talking about things that you just want to hear more. And so many people from that generation credit that TV show for their love of science. And I think that those are sort of the gold standards. If there were a show like that today, I think that it should involve some aspect more of technology, just because it's so mm-hmm. pervasive in so many ways. There are so many topics. I mean, you know, like, and it's something I know about is robots, and a lot of people are scared of robots. And I think that there's a lot of reasons for this. I think one of them is just not really understanding what's in their minds. What do they want? What are they thinking? It's mm-hmm. just this blank, mask of a thing that's doing a thing. And that's creepy because it doesn't feel like a person. But it kind of looks like an animal moving around sometimes. So, I would want a show where I want there to be a show that, like, where you really dive into the details, where he pulls you in. This is what this is actually doing when it's moving. When this thing is moving its arm, it doesn't have the feeling, oh, I should move my arm like we might. It's an equation, just this very simple equation. It's like four letters. It's this one little equation called a PD controller. What does it do? And I love to demystify things. So if I were to put a show on the air that I'd somehow have some say over, it would be demystifying technology in the modern world, specifically robotics, because that's something I could talk more. I could talk more about, where I could guide a show more on. So, and if you needed a hook, the problem is sometimes you need a hook for these things. And if you wanted more of a hook, like Mythbusters was a great show, for instance, and had a great hook, which is this myth you believe true or not? True or not? Boom. Mm-hmm. I think if you're going to do something with robots, I think that sort of like a humans versus machines kind of competition might be more fun. Like, what's better at, poker? a person or this algorithm. And actually, you know, just because this is a Survivor podcast and people will know about this, you know, extreme couponing. Okay. Who's better, this algorithm or Sandra Diaz-Twine? Yeah, Sandra. Isn't Sandra, she's an extreme couponer, right?
Yes.
The algorithms for extreme couponing, I think, is a very tricky algorithm for computers to do. Like, mm-hmm. And it doesn't have – who's better? You know, these people who do it, or algorithms okay. better at it, and it might not be clear. So things are all aspects of life.
As long as I think the season finale, you get back to the sex robot, I think then maybe this is a huge hit.
Yeah, the head to head competition with
watching.
Yes, she will be. That you know, we wonder how the censors would handle the head to head competitions on that.
Easy. Family podcast. Yeah.
Family podcast. Well, there was a show where they went into like a box or something like that and they did that kind of thing.
I think they made an international show. I don't know.
Oh, was it an international show? Okay. All right, never mind.
Okay. The Great Antonio writes in to ask us, who is your favorite Better Call Saul character and why? I didn't know we were going to talk so much about Better Call Saul already, but do you have a favorite Better Call Saul character? I saw that the teaser just dropped for the final season of Better Call Saul.
Oh, did it? I'm not going to watch it just because I want to know nothing about it before it comes out. Even so, I want to know nothing about it. Okay. It's exciting. I love that show. So the final season's coming out presumably sometime in 2020 to 2022. Hopefully sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. I think it's split into two seasons. They're doing the split thing. There's a lot of great characters. I love the character of Chuck from Better Call Saul.
Yes.
Chuck. So Chuck is the brother, the older brother of Jimmy McGill, Michael McKean. And he is more or less, you know, mild spoilers, more or less a villain on that show. But I think that the best villains on these shows, they don't think they're villains. They think they're doing what's right. They think they're doing what is necessary. I think that a lot of people, I mean, just from a completely different universe of villains, I mean, like the Thanos. I think a lot of people were really taken in by Thanos because Thanos was a character he thought he was doing was right.
Yeah.
Yeah. In his mind, it made sense. And to some degree, it needs to make sense in the audience too. And Michael McKean's Chuck character is, he's a high powered and very righteous lawyer, self-righteous lawyer, in fact. But Saul Goodman is his younger brother, now Jimmy McGill, and he can see the tension in what he excuses the way he undercuts Jimmy by it being for the good of the legal profession, that the law is sacred and what he does it violates that sanctity of the law. But you also get insight into the fact that he is also resentful that people like Jimmy and people, but they don't like him so much. And they give you just the great little snippets and the way he acts it, you see the internal tension and it leads to one of the greatest climaxes I've seen on TV, which is the episode called Chicanery, which I won't spoil, where there's a bit of a courtroom scene. I love that episode so much. It's one of those scenes that I can watch. And I have every beat of every enunciation of every word memorized. It's like music.
How many times have you watched it?
Probably a dozen times. Wow. Yeah. It's one of those things. It's one of those comfort shows for me that I can put on episodes.
You watch Better Call Saul 12 times? You watch that episode 12 times?
I watched the episode 12 times. I've probably seen all of Better Call Saul, you know, probably 4 or 5 times now.
Wow.
I'm really into that show. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but I love the way that they are telling the story. And it's a slow burn. I think that they hit certain things along the way. Like it knows how to keep me engaged at least. And it's not a perfect show. I would say if people wanted to hear things I don't like about the show, I could probably list those off too. But overall, I can just soak it in. And it's got a lot of great characters and it's a classic. I mean, and some of these new characters.
All right.
Yeah. Mike is fine.
Yeah, that's my Mike. That's my Mike. That's
your Mike Erbach. I'm familiar with
you.
It's all right. I mean, there's a. I think I've mentioned with you before when I talk. I think I talked about it on my Dice Factory Vicky number two. I want to say. One thing I like about the show is that it'll take material that is pretty dry, but make it interesting.
Like there's a salami sandwich cold cuts without the olive oil.
Oh, I believe, you know, as a Better Call Saul fan, I know that Mike is a fan of pimento cheese sandwiches, pimento cheese sandwiches. But it takes dry material like a pimento cheese sandwich, or like my favorite was like there's a malpractice insurance hike on Charles's insurance, and it's a major plot point.
Yeah,
and it's a good scene. I love it. And yeah. So I love Charles because he's the kind of villain who doesn't know he's a villain, doesn't think of himself as a villain. And the show, you could get in your own head. It's like, yeah, you know, in a way, he's right. I mean, in actuality, he is right. You know, we see what Jimmy is like in the next season, in the next series. You know, he's a scumbag lawyer. So, yeah.
Okay. Christian, Trevor wants to know, what is your favorite type of quadrilateral?
So my favorite type of quadrilateral is a rhombus. So
okay. Now, a quadrilateral is a shape with four sides, right?
Exactly. Quadrilateral, it's a shape with four sides. And there are lots of types of quadrilaterals. So there's the trapezoid. There are parallelograms.
Yep.
Square. You know, some people like squares. Mm-hmm. But my favorite is the rhombus, probably because it's got the coolest name. And so I imagine not everyone remembers what a rhombus is from grade school, but it's a square that's basically, imagine you just kind of like, you know, lean to the side. You kind of pushed on it and it's leaning to the side. So by definition, it has all equal sides, but it doesn't have to have all right angles like a square.
Mm.
So whereas a parallelogram, a rectangle has all squares, has all 90 degree sides, all right angles, but doesn't have the same sides, same sides of sides. So it's kind of like the opposite of that. But it's got a cool name, rhombus. I actually tried to, you know, one time I was like, what does rhombus even come from? How does it come up with that word? And it's a really obscure origin. Mm-hmm. It has to do with like bullfighting in Greece, ancient Greece or something. It's like there's some kind of weird device that they would spin on the ground to irritate the bull that looked like the shape, and it was called like a rhombus or something like that. So they call it a rhombus. It's weird.
Yeah. Christian, is this question a plant how did Trevor think to ask about your favorite type of quadrilateral? And then how did he know that you had one?
So I have a hypothesis. One day I may have been with my phone drinking one or too many beers. Mm-hmm. And I just typed and I tweeted out just the word rhombus.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you know, that's the only thing I can think of. Someone went way back.
This wasn't the night that you went to the Magic the Gathering tournament, right?
No, that's a different night. That's I have a variety of impulses apparently when I have a few too many beers. One is the Magic the Gathering tournament. Now I have a collection, you know, right here of cards. This is what happened as a result of my So that's the only thing I can think of.
What is your beer of choice?
I used to be a huge fan of IPAs, and more recently, I'm more lighters. I'll like a Kolsch that has a nice full body to it. I'll enjoy
Kolsch. Is that a brand or that's a type of beer?
That's a type of beer. So it's like a lighter, It's I think I want to say it's of German origin, but it's very drinkable. But it can err on being maybe a little bit too light.
Like
but
a VLT without the avocado.
Exactly. Your analogies are very on point. They should put you on Survivor. But I was a big fan of hoppy IPAs for a long time. And I think only recently I'm enjoying some more lighter beers.
Hi. Let me give you one more question. Okay. This is from Alec, not the guy from the White Lotus. Okay.
Are we sure?
All right. It's for Alec M. In your professional scientific opinion, how much longevity can Survivor really have? How much longer can the show go on? How much longer can Jeff be the host? And can the show survive a hypothetical Probst retirement? Is it reasonable to expect anyone to have an answer to these questions. I guess that Alec wants to know about the heat death of Survivor.
Yeah, I remember searching a long time ago. I was just looking up Survivor ratings.
Yeah.
And I pulled up an article on Google, and it was like, can Survivor last much longer with these ratings? I was reading this article. I was like, well, wait, this doesn't seem very topical. And it was from 2002, or it was 2002. Yes. It was talking about Survivor Thailand. Mm-hmm. So that's what people. So they all. This is always a conversation that people seem to have. Like, how much longer can it go on? It's a good formula.
Yeah.
It's. I mean, I think that there isn't necessarily an upper limit on the formula. I mean, we're now seeing it replicate. I mean, even with, I think Jeff is a great host. I think he cares a lot. I think it's one of the reasons that the show has really endured with such strength for so many years. And but like, I mean, there are versions that do not have him internationally, even though a lot of them kind of dress like him. Do they all have like the same phrases? It's uniform, right? So it's like Indiana Jones. Is the character important, or is it the thing he wears? I don't know. In terms of the longevity of the franchise, and so, but like, I think that the formula is strong, and I don't think that it's limited to Jeff. So I think that the. And the worst thing that can happen in terms of like interest in the show, like, would be something like American Idoling itself out, like, so to speak. Where American Idol kind of dwindled eventually, and then eventually got canceled, but then it came back. Is it back again? Is it still back at this point?
I'm not sure if it's active. I think it is.
Yeah. So, but like, it's the sort of thing that even if for some reason,
I'm not sure if they did a cycle this year.
Yeah, for some reason, it's such a money making show. But if it ever got to the point where it wasn't, it's such a good formula. I think it would come back again. I think it would get a resurgence. I think people would miss it. I think there are people enjoy it for all sorts of reasons. It's got a little something for everyone, and so I think that's one of the reasons that is so successful. And I'm always amazed at the reasons people will have for loving it. I once had a conversation with Mike White, and he talked about one of the reasons that he loves the show. And he talked about this publicly in one of his interviews that he likes that the show is like murder. That it's like you're murdering people, but you're not actually. So you get the feel of murdering people without actually murdering people. I'm like, that's interesting, Mike. Let's be allies. I think that was a questionable decision. Mm-hmm.
He said this on the island. It's like murder.
Yeah, I think he said that, and he told me later. So I think it's both true in the game and out of the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that should have been a clue not to trust him. But the in the game, but people, he's that sort of an esoteric view of it. But some people love the return to the simple. They love the return to something primitive and see how they do. Some people love the drama. Some people love the strategy. Some people love the ideas that come up on the show, and being a microcosm of society. Yeah. It's just got so much going.
Sure.
The competition. Yeah, the competitions. Yeah, like, you know, the struggle of an underdog winning in a competition. Yeah,
look at Buffalo Eric. He loves to watch it with his kids.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Yeah. So it's got something for everyone. And so I don't think that you could put an upper limit on its on its longevity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it survived a year hiatus,
right?
After COVID, and people were just begging for it to return. And so it's got a lot of strength.
Yeah. I think there was a point where I don't think Survivor could have gone on without Jeff. But I think that we are sort of on the other side of that.
Mm. I agree. I think it's now an institution. It's a staple. I mean, there might have been a time. Yeah, I think I agree with you on that assessment, where it could have just been like all of the memes that came out of Survivor, like the tribe has spoken. Oh, you snuffed your torch. Mm-hmm. Oh, you got voted off the island. Those could have just been like relics of a bygone era. Like people talking about, you are the weakest link, goodbye. You know how long lasting that was, right? It could have been like that. But I think that it's been around for a generation.
Yeah.
But I think Price is Right.
Yeah. And they did change the host of The Price is Right. And The Price is Right continues to go along. And I feel like that, you know, in the timeline where the Jeff Probst show becomes like a fantastic hit and Jeff Probst doesn't come back to Survivor and make a season, you know, 27 of Survivor. Like, I could see a scenario where season 26 is the last season. Maybe they come back and reboot it a couple of years later, maybe with, you know, a different host perhaps. But I think at this point, you know, I think that it might be certainly like might make there be more interest in Survivor if there was like a different creative direction.
I think that there would be some interest there. I can totally see it. Mm-hmm. And the I think the line was, you say it's 26, 27. I say it was like around One World, when Jeff wasn't even showing up for the challenges. You remember, mm-hmm. like he's doing this kind of those DIY challenges that are like, they would just send something and have Troy's Ann narrate it instead. And at that point you felt like, and Jeff was trying to do Jeff Probst show. He'd do his own Jeff Probst show.
That when they did the Jeff Probst show, I think that they filmed 25 and 26, like on a little bit of an accelerated timeline so that Jeff had more time to go do the Jeff Probst talk show. And I think that there was like 16 months or whatever, where it was like built into the schedule where he was going to go do this thing. And if it would, and if it hit, I don't know what they were going to do with Survivor, but left the door open in case it bombed or didn't, succeed for whatever reason, he could come back to Survivor.
Interesting. I didn't know a lot of those details there, but that makes sense. I mean, it's also was a time where, you know, while there were some good players came out of some of those seasons, you know, I think that even when I was watching at that point, it just didn't have that zest for like, as a season. And so, I think since we're past that, I think Kageyan, I always thought that Kageyan was always that juice that the franchise showed that this can be rejuvenated
with new players. Cause it's blood versus water. Yeah. I think they love the format, but that was returnees. And then, three tribes and, Tony and everything. I think then, that really gave it a lot of juice. I think also there's a universe where, Survivor Micronesia is the last season of the show. And, you know, had that not been as great of a season, I think that that gave it a lot of energy where they're like, okay, well, we're at 16, let's get to 20.
Yeah. I mean, we could even talk about, like, I remember, like, you had said in the past, like, people like Russell Hance at season 19 were just like, oh, something fresh and new at the time, like, this character. Like, you were still, like, they were still, like, and they would glom on to those characters. I mean, they brought him back for 3 out of 4 seasons.
Right. No, and Russell did a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they might have been at a point where it's like, all right, we just did 18. Let's get to 20 and we'll call it a show. And then Russell comes along. It's like, whoa, hold on. Oh, this is, we got something here. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that at this point, like I've seen so many cycles of the ideas that, you know, I mean, anything can happen to a show. There are all kinds, like, you know, there could be some disaster. I won't speculate on those, but in terms of just general interest in the show, it would take a lot to just completely tank it. I think it would have to be a series of really of lackluster creative decisions. So hopefully we won't get there.
I just watched a TikTok today where Jesse Tannenbaum was talking about, like, okay, we're closing the books on seasons 43 and 44. Doesn't mean we didn't like you. Just the themes weren't right or whatever. And come back in September when we start looking at seasons 45 and 46.
There you go. Yeah, that's what they're thinking at this point. I mean, I don't know much about the business side of Survivor money making, but like it's a top flight reality show, but it's still a reality show. They don't cost that much to make.
I think they're doing fine with the finance. Yeah. Survivor David versus Goliath a few times a week.
That's impressive. That's a lot. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm sorry that my voice is in your head all the time, or, that's why I'm saying I'm sorry. I let you enjoy it. But that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This question is not from Nick Wilson, is it?
Nick Wilson would know the answer to this question.
Okay.
I think,
all right. So the question is, this person has one question. They watch David versus Goliath multiple times a week.
That's a lot. Yeah.
I need to know. I really need to know. How did you rip your shirt? It's the one. They're one question.
They're one question. How did you rip my shirt?
I would imagine hundreds of times.
That's good eye for noticing the ripped shirt. I think he's referring. I actually have the shirt right here. I could probably pull it out and go grab it.
All right. If you've listened to 2.5 hours of this podcast, we've been on video the whole time. So Christian is going to get a visual aid here.
Okay.
His wardrobe from Survivor. Davis Glide. He has it on a hanger, wire hanger.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it was my wire. So it's I have for the video podcast listeners, you can see, actually make sure I get the light here. I have my robot shirt from the island.
Yes.
Okay. And so I believe what's this gentleman's name? Anonymous?
Anonymous. It could be a woman.
It could be, it's not an anonymous person, she or he.
Yeah.
And so this, I think they're referring to this hole right here.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So happened? Right down the set. It's just too tight and I just stretched and it broke. So
real?
It's the water shrunk the shirt. In fact, if it was Nick Wilson who's secretly asking this question, one thing Nick and I around when we were hanging around David Beach, this shirt got so tight when it shrank up, I had to have him help me take it off. So like I had to sort of basically put my hands over my head and he would just kind of, that's on camera. That's actually in the episode two.
Mm-hmm.
One of the scenes in episode two, that's when we were palling around and making Mason Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
So it just was really tight and just would slowly rip over time. That's why the rip in the shirt. So it wasn't some crazy stunt. It was just too tight. And it would just slowly this shirt, a lot of these are holes from the island, but many were there beforehand. I remember that. So this is not a new shirt. This is a shirt from the 1970s. What? You don't know. This is a shirt that it's an heirloom from Emily's grandparents' shirt collection that they had from the 1970s.
Wow. So you wore a antique shirt. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. When you go on Survivor, do you still need to provide doubles of your shirt for the Dream Team?
No, we didn't. They didn't. I didn't have to provide a double for the Dream Team at all. So they must have made like a replica of the shirt. I took a picture of the logo before it got, all faded when on the island in case everyone wanted to recreate it. I would not know where to buy such a shirt nowadays. In fact, the cut is weird of this, of the shirt. This is the robot shirt I wore on the island for people who are listening. And it's a very long cut. It doesn't resemble any modern cut for a men's shirt. And the tag was in the front of the shirt. It was just odd.
Was that irritating?
Yeah, a little bit, but more so to the production than it was for me. I remember in one of my first Survivor confessionals, I was wearing this shirt. They're like, your tag keeps coming out. Come here, Christian. And they whipped out a switchblade and sliced it off. So it's they just cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no tag on the front anymore as a result. So, but this is a shirt that I happen to have been gifted by Emily's family.
Yes.
It's like, oh, Christian, you like robots? Here's a robot shirt. I wore it in my casting video, and then I wore it to my interviews, and they're like, Christian, we want you to wear it on the island. It's like, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah. And then you washed it when you came home.
No, it's never been washed.
For serious?
For all serious, it's never been washed since I got home.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it's just, I don't know. Yeah, it smells like the island, kind of. So,
I was going to say that I feel like I don't know if it was going to survive the washing machine.
Yeah, I did not. I didn't know what to do with it. I just kind of just left it here.
Hand wash, Woolite.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I just kind of, there's something about the authenticity that this is how it came. This is how I left the game. I don't know. That's just not, that's how I see it. So yeah, I have all my clothes and canteen and things from the island, and I just haven't touched them since, and so many years since I was on the island.
Okay. Well, Christian, do you have any questions for me?
What you got coming up in the podcast this week, Rob?
So many. Let's talk about you.
So, no, it's, this is, no, it's, Yeah. So this has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate all the questions that have been coming by. Mm-hmm. I love that they all somehow touch on information theory and or the heat death of the universe.
Yes.
But that's good. It's been fun, and I look forward to hopefully season 42 coming up soon in the timeline.
Yeah. Coming up, premiering on March 9th.
Yeah, it should be exciting. Yeah, and what else is going on here in the early 2022 timeframe? Could we foresee a sequel to Ask Dr. Hubicki, perhaps? And you know, when there's a lull again, in the
certainly anytime you want to do it. I find these conversations wonderful. I hope that the listeners do. I think they do. I think they like it. Hard to say. We're in the middle of it, and we're not getting any feedback right now. So please, if you like it, let at Chubicki know.
Yeah. Well, it says, yeah. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun. I love answering people's questions. So I appreciate everyone who took the time to ask them. Feel free, if you had a question that you wish I answered, you can just pop it in the responses to this podcast announcement on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I guess you can find me on Twitter at Chubicki, at Chubicki.
How's your Twitch doing? Are you doing much streaming?
A little bit. So I did a stream with Gabby recently, like I mentioned, and I did a little bit of a stream earlier in the year. So it's on, off and on. So I'll typically announce it on Twitter, or just see if you follow me on Twitter, you'll get an announcement if I give one. I do it when I feel like it.
Yeah.
And that's when I like it, and it's fun.
It's the way to do it. Okay. Yeah. Well, we've got so much going on right now. Really, it's a rare time where we have the big three of CBS reality all in season at the same or about to be in season between The Amazing Race and Big Brother Celebrity and Survivor. So we're talking about everything right now. Make sure you follow what we're doing when you hit robhasawebsite.com/subscribe. And we've got a ton of stuff going on. We're previewing Survivor 42 and much more, all on RHAP. Christian, thank you. I can't thank you enough for spending this time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and best of luck with all the it's probably crazy podcasting season coming up.
It's a wild season, but you know, we're having a lot of fun. Thank you so much for watching or listening to this podcast. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.